çok kötü diyor ama Türkiye'de kutlayayım.
Mutlaka kutlayayım. Thank you.
Honorable Minister, Director General of National Treasury, the Commissioner, Mr. Mahashule from SARS, I see in your team you have Ivan there. Let me welcome all of you here. Momo, I don't know for some reason you've decided to take a back seat today, but you're welcome too. Minister, thank you for heeding our request as Parliament to come and interact with the Standing Committee on Finance and the Select Committee. This is a joint sitting of the Select Committee of Finance in the NCOP and the Standing Committee on Finance in the National Assembly. As we might all be aware of the fact that the process that we're embarking on is not a usual process, in the sense that the annual reports that have been presented to this honorable members, at the end of the day, we have a responsibility not only to report to the House, but also to make recommendations that will inform the next budget cycle in terms of your programs as National Treasury and all other family institutions that are related to National Treasury. So it is a very, very important process that will help us as Parliament to ensure that the objectives that you've set for yourself in your strategic plans are indeed evaluated in a more thorough way. I would therefore take this opportunity to hand over to you, Minister, to lead us on how you intend to interact with the two respective committees present here. Thank you and welcome.
So thank you, Mr. Mufumari and Mr. De Beer, chairpersons, and members of the two committees, for the opportunity for the two key institutions in the finance family, the Treasury and SARS, to interact with the committee on the performance of the two institutions in the period 2009-2010. And what I propose after consultation with you, Chairperson, is that I'll speak briefly to provide an overview. The DP of the Treasury will then take you through his presentation and introduce you to his team. And the Commissioner will also introduce his team and take you through his presentation. And I believe you will then take questions for both after those presentations, so I'll appeal to them to be brief as well. In providing, I'm sorry, I'm going to be coughing on and off, I'm not too well. Let me firstly also apologize for the Deputy Minister. He has a bereavement in the family, and that required him to return to KwaZulu-Natal, so apologies on his behalf for not being here. We are so far down 2010 that we've almost forgotten what 2009 felt like. But let's remind, this is an opportunity to remind ourselves that 2009, the calendar year, marked the period of the worst recession in 70 years to strike both the world at large and South Africa. Some, I believe, will say that the impact of this recession in terms of its breadth and its depth across the globe was far greater than even the Great Depression of the 1920s and 1930s. And that's probably true because the world in 2009 and 2010 is a lot more globalized, is a lot more connected, the financial system is a lot more developed, and that's putting it mildly because the reach of the financial system globally is far greater than anything you could have imagined in the 1920s. And so the impact of this recession has been huge. It's in that context that we have to ask, how does South Africa cope? And whether and how the two key institutions that influence our economy, SARS and the NT, manage the responsibilities that they actually had during this period. The strategic plans and so on would have said the normal things, but they've had to both, as leaders and as staff in the two institutions, do extraordinary things, and things also outside of the normal experience of many of us, in order to ensure that we steer the country's economy in a way in which we come out as unscathed as possible, which is of course extremely difficult, but something that we can at least attempt to do. What does that involve? Well, in the case of the National Treasury, it involved understanding what's the depth of this recession, what's the impact of the financial crisis, and in the first instance, whether our own banking and financial systems were resilient enough. We've learned now that our systems were indeed resilient, our regulators were good, our banking system has survived extremely well and is one of a handful of banking systems in the world, together with Australia, Canada, India, and Brazil, that have survived in the way that we did survive in South Africa. Second is what would our economic and fiscal response be to this crisis? And you remember then when we, as this administration took office in mid-May last year, one of the first things that we had to do in early July when Parliament met and we addressed your committee, Chairperson, was to make a call on whether what extent we would engage in increasing our deficit in order to absorb the shock of the recession. And from a very low deficit, we then decided, and although we were feeling our way, if you remember initially, June, July, August, September last year, first we thought there would be a 50 billion rand drop in revenue, then we got closer to 60, and eventually closer to 70 billion rand loss in revenue. And the key decision made during that period on the advice of the Treasury was, let's borrow the money, let's not compromise the delivery programs of government. We've, in the previous years, created the fiscal space to be able to do the borrowing and absorb the shock that these sorts of cycles present to us. And so ultimately, by the time the MTBPS took place a year ago, we said that our deficit will go up to 7.3%. In the final instance, the flip side of this coin was, what would SARS do? And how will they cope in the context of such a huge drop in revenue? And remember, what we're talking about is a drop from close on to 28.5% tax GDP ratio that we had achieved just before this period, and what ultimately turned out to be just over 24% tax GDP ratio. So it's a phenomenal drop in the revenue process. Our SARS colleagues at the same time, as you will hear, put together, as is their tradition, plans to say, yes, we will have to accept that there's some drop in revenue, but there are some extraordinary things that we could do to avoid revenue leakage, to ensure that we tighten up on the compliance side, and that we, to the extent is possible, hold on to some of the lost ground. And the reports that you will hear today will indicate to you the extent that they were able to do that. And ultimately, our deficit came down because of slightly better collection in revenue and a bit of underspending, down from 7.3% to 6.7%. Let's also remind ourselves that this was a period in which there were massive job losses. Now, this has now become an international phenomenon. Countries like Spain are beginning to have numbers like ours, because if we say our unemployment rate is about 25%, Spain has already hit 20%. The United States is above 10%. So the loss of jobs has been quite significant. In our case, almost 1 million jobs during this period have been lost. But the way the recovery occurs is that jobs take a longer time to recover. So you can have the numbers that will show and will avoid the temptation of saying things now that we want to say in the MTBPS, so you'll protect us in that regard. So the numbers will indicate that, yes, growth is returning, but employment is not returning just as fast. In fact, there are still sectors where employment is being lost. And there's a particular character about the loss of employment in South Africa. A lot of it is happening at the lower end, except for some recent announcements by some institutions that they're going to cut jobs at the higher end. So at some stage here, it'll be useful for the committees to also inquire about the employment trends in South Africa and what happens in these sorts of periods. what are the unique characteristics that we seem to demonstrate in this sort of period. We did put together, as a country, some sort of safety net and a framework to respond to the recession. But all in all, whilst tens of thousands of jobs were in fact saved, our response hasn't been able to meaningfully dent the large number of people who actually lost their jobs. You will recall that during this period we were also fortunate that the infrastructure investments that we had started, particularly heading up to what was eventually an extremely successful World Cup in June, July 2010, carried us fairly well during this period as well. The challenge for us as we go forward is, what's the next, if you like, World Cup-style infrastructure investment? And that, again, will only emerge in the next few months as we finish our budgeting processes. Here again, in respect of the preparations for the World Cup, the Commissioner will report that both within SARS itself and some of its sister organizations, they did extremely well to ensure that South Africa would be prepared for the rush of visitors that we had during that time. We've just come back, the DG and myself, from the IMF and World Bank meetings, I don't know what to say, World Cup, in Washington last week. And here again, the indications are that growth in the developed part of the world is going to be fairly modest, that the recovery is there, but is highly uncertain, given some of the new imbalances that are coming to the fore around the globe. Secondly, that it's still, as we said earlier to you, is becoming more and more confirmed now, that it's the emerging market economies that are carrying the world, and the kind of average growth of between 4.5 and 6%. The IMF keeps jumping a little bit in that range. And so you've had an interesting switch in the last year from a situation where we were totally dependent on advanced countries for maintaining high levels of growth in the world to now being totally dependent on three or four countries in the emerging world, China, India, Brazil, amongst others, and some of the middle-sized economies. The challenge for South Africa is that even if we get modest improvements in growth, and we'll give you the numbers on the 27th of October, that's not good enough to tackle the unemployment and other challenges that we face. And so we come back to the familiar ground. How do we do better? What do we do differently? And how do we more energetically tackle some of the issues that we have and which you can address immediately after the MTBPS with you? At the Washington meetings, over and above the recovery and its nature and where it's going and what the risks are, the second issue, which I'm sure all of you are tempted to ask questions about, and certainly our colleagues from the press are very interested in, is the currency. This dominated both quiet discussions and not so quiet discussions in Washington as well. And what's clear now, Chairperson, is that South Africa is not uniquely facing the problem of appreciating currency or appreciating rand. This is becoming a global phenomenon amongst economies, particularly that have lots of commodity trading and resources. And so countries like Brazil, Australia, South Africa, but now even Thailand, Indonesia, Korea, amongst others, are all impacted by appreciating currencies. What we need to appreciate better in South Africa is that whilst there are some country-specific trends that give rise to the capital flows that we have seen, there's a wider set of structural problems in the world. And that those structural problems won't be solved by unilateral action by a few countries in a disparate and uncoordinated basis on their own. The hope is that having highlighted these sorts of challenges, having highlighted the imbalances that are creating the problems that we are seeing, the fact that some countries still want to do further so-called quantitative easing, meaning putting more money into the marketplace, and having very low interest rates in their countries, which means you can borrow at a very low rate and come to any one of our countries that have higher interest rates. Brazil is 9%, we are 6%, and so on. And you just bring in money on a short-term basis, make a profit if you like, and then move on. So the carry trade, the investment in equities and bonds, amongst other things, is a set of trends that everybody has now noticed around the world. Everybody is, in fact, very concerned about. And there's also consensus that unless the G20 takes on the responsibility of getting the major players to sit around the table and to find a spirit of cooperation and generosity and give and take, which is what's going to be required if we are going to find a structural problem, or rather solution to the problem on a global basis. We are heading for what Mr. Manteiga, the Minister of Finance of Brazil, correctly called a currency war. Everybody would want to depreciate their currency. Everyone wants to export their way out of trouble. And there's no place to import now because everybody wants to export. So there are a set of, if you like, global structural problems that we're walking into that we will have to give serious attention to in the next few weeks. The committee might be aware that next week the finance ministers meet, as do their deputies in Korea, and then a few weeks later the G20 leaders meet in Seoul. And by that time, we've got to find some answers to this question. The additional phenomenon that we picked up in Washington and discussed at quite some length is the reform of the international institutions, IMF and the World Bank, which has also been a long-standing subject both outside of the G20 and within the G20 as well. South Africa and Australia co-chair a group within the G20 which is responsible for making proposals on the reform of the Bretton Woods institutions. And much to our shock last week, although there was agreement that there would be, as part of this reform, a shift in quotas or shares from developed countries to developing countries, or as we put it, from the haves to the have-nots, formulae began to emerge last week which showed that countries like South Africa and Nigeria on the African continent must lose bits of their quota, almost 20%, in order that other smaller developing countries can gain some quota. So you're taking from the have-nots to give to other have-nots, rather than taking from haves to give to the have-nots. So there's an intensive process of negotiation going on. Our DG has been involved quite closely in that, and he can brief you a little bit. But we hope that there will be a more just outcome by the time this matter reaches the leaders' meeting of the G20 in Seoul. On the revenue side, there are, as a result of the monthly figures that you see, indications this year, the commissioner will report about last year, that things are looking better. The only thing I want to caution us about is that these better numbers don't necessarily indicate that suddenly there's a massive recovery or that the tax base has grown or suddenly South Africans who traditionally have withheld some money in their pockets have become generous because Christmas has arrived. There are technical reasons for some of these revenue numbers and in particular VAT refunds have slowed down because investment is slowing down both in the private sector and in the public sector, and we'll give you numbers on the 27th of October to indicate that. Similarly, SARS will explain to you the rules have changed for the payment of provisional tax for corporates. And so we're pulling money, if you like, into this year that actually belongs to next year. And so we just want to make sure that not too many people get too excited that there's too much of money around. And you're going to help us to dampen the spirits a little bit, Chairperson. To summarize, if we look back to 2009-10, the theory of, if you like, practicing counter-cyclical macroeconomic policies were indeed put in place, and it'll be good to get the Treasury officials to interact with you on that. Often we see this as a theoretical construct, but last year we had to demonstrate what counter-cyclicality actually meant. But we also got to extrapolate from last year and say when times become better, what will counter-cyclicality mean? Meaning that if there's remarkable growth X years from now and there's lots of revenue coming in, then government has to move into a different cycle in terms of how it spends money. So counter-cyclicality doesn't mean you keep spending and increasing the spend on money. And the key focus, of course, on our side, as both the heads of the two institutions will indicate to you, is not how much of money we have to spend in South Africa, but what's the quality of the outcome that we are obtaining and the quality of the spend. And so we would recommend to you strongly, as the two committees, that that is something that you focus on. So all in all, 2009-10, South Africa can be very proud that our banking system held up, our regulatory system held up, our countercyclical responses worked. We did our best in terms of getting sustaining compliance and collecting revenue. Secondly, that as we move out of that particular period into the current fiscal year, while things are looking better, there are a whole lot of other risks that we didn't have last year that we have this year that we have to anticipate. Thank you very much, Shepard.
Thank you, Chair. excuse me. I will skip the first two slides, which is for what the minister had talked to. Also say that we had sort of like, as we present the annual report, we had the trial exam in this same room when we spoke to the Appropriations Committee 2 months ago. I'd like to say, restate what the Treasury does, that as the Treasury we are responsible for managing South Africa's national government finances, and that we draw our mandate from Chapter 2 of the Public Finance Management Act, read with Chapter 13 of the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa. We continue to monitor the impact of the global financial crisis, and were able to find appropriate responses to the crisis. The budget process was enhanced as a result of the Money Bills Amendment Procedures Act of 2009, and we increased our capacity by creating a division handling our international and our regional economic policy. So what we're going to present here as the annual report is the work of dedicated men and women in the Treasury. Some of them are here, and they are responsible for various divisions. I've got Makgoshi Phetla at the end there, raise your hand, who is the head of international and regional economic policy. Next to her is Ghulam Abubakar, who is in the DG's office. Ghulam, I presume you are not standing up, but if you raise your hand, they will know who you are. next to him is Lungisa Fuzile, who is the head of assets and liabilities management. And next to him is Fundi Chativana, who is the chief director for microeconomic analysis, standing in for Christopher Lowald, the head of economic policy, who is attending the OECD macro forecasting meeting. And Matthew Simmons is the acting head of the budget office, is the chief director of fiscal policy in the Treasury. And Freeman Nomvalo, a man who does not need much introduction, he is a regular visitor here. He is the accountant general. Next to him is Kenneth Brown. Kenneth Brown is the head of intergovernmental relations. And Malcolm Simpson, our World Cup man, he is now responsible for infrastructure in the Treasury. Hope that we would leverage on his experience from the World Cup to help us deliver the infrastructure. Kun Kruger is an old timer. He is the head of specialist services, is responsible for systems and procurement. Marion Mbina is the head of corporate services in the Treasury. And Radu Majeke is the chief financial officer. And then I've got Jabulani Skakani, who is the head of communications in the Treasury. And my man on the ground, Mbekile Nachi, is here. And the man in the green tie is the the chief of staff of the ministry has got a range of titles, but we'll stick to this one. At the back there, the man who seems not to want to be seen is Ismail Momoniat, who is the head of the tax policy and financial sector policy unit. And right at the back there is Keshia Singh, who is also in the communications section. So those are the men and women who, after I have presented, will answer all the committee's difficult questions. Just to highlight, because the annual report soon is there, and we have tabled the, we have got tables, service delivery tables there that report on each one of the programs and covers in exactly the same format what was contained in the strategic plan update. So I will just go through a few highlights. We have had our credit ratings maintained as BBB+ by Fitch and Standard & Poor's, while Moody's upgraded our long-term foreign currency rating to A3 from Baa1, and this has demonstrated confidence in our macroeconomic policies and our fiscal policies. That as a percentage of GDP remains low relative to many developed economies, even if it is rising over the next 3 years of the MTEF. Infrastructure spend had boosted economic activity, especially in the construction sector. You would recall that infrastructure was South Africa's preferred response to the global economic crisis. We had also now this year created a specialized audit services unit to provide forensic investigations and consultancy services to different entities on tender-related issues. This unit is located in the office of the accountant general. It has turned out to be one of the busiest units now in the Treasury. It works in a multi-agency forum with South African Revenue Services and the Financial Intelligence Center and the Special Investigations Unit. Our financial sector, as Minister had earlier said, have got very high regulatory standards, and these high regulatory standards have helped to ensure that our banking system remains sound and relatively unscathed by the global financial crisis. Even after the adoption of the new higher standards in terms of financial regulation, South African banks are still having capital adequacy ratios that are above the world average. So we are on a very sound wicket here. Let me then get on to the details of the program, starting with Program 2, which is the public finance and budget management program. This program used to be called budget management and economic planning. We have since split economics from this, and economics is now program 6. So this is now just public finance and budget management. And it's divided into three divisions, and start here with the budget office, that in terms of what we had committed ourselves to do, we had ensured that the budget framework for MTBPS and the budget review were tabled on time, and that included an estimate of the structural budget budget balance. What had also distinguished this year's budget review was an inclusion of long-term fiscal scenarios. What do we see happening to the fiscal over the next 5, over the next 10 years, to stress test what we foresee happening over that period. The division also continued to find savings as part of the drive to ensure efficiency in the public sector. And in October, we will give when the MTBPS is tabled, we will give an update of the exact amounts that had been realized. Suffice to say that we did realize significant savings at the time of the presentation of the budget in February. There's been a notable improvement in the quality of performance information, including public entity indicators, and that we have introduced which these indicators now ensure consistency of targets, especially related to the allocations of resources. The division has introduced a simplified version of the consolidated government account in 2010 budget, and going forward, you'd realize as we present the budget and the budget policy statement, we will be talking more about the consolidated government account rather than just the national budget account. We are left to then produce an updated version of the reference guide to the economic reporting format with corresponding classification circulars used by departments to classify transactions. And we have also witnessed an increase in the number of reports from departments receiving overseas development assistance funding. The next sub-program is public finance, which focuses on tracking expenditure of national government departments and studying the policy, the impact of various policies that emanate from line function department. And the division net provided valuable policy analysis on sector-specific and departmental issues during the period under review. It has conducted pre-MSEC meetings, this is the Medium-Term Expenditure Committee, with each department to improve the input into the deliberation of the Medium-Term Expenditure Committee. So, whereas previously we just had departments coming to the committee stating these are the kinds of resources they are looking for, the process had been changed in the period under review, where there is an engagement with the individual departments before they actually come to the committee. So this has ensured that all national departments have measurable objectives per program and a selected set of 10 to 12 service delivery indicators, and this would be captured in the estimates of national expenditure, the ENE. What had consumed most of the time of this division had been the work around social security reform. There's a consolidated government paper that is being further developed following comments from members of the various departments that constitute the interdepartmental task team on social security, retirement reform, and social health and national health insurance. And this committee does report through to an interministerial committee. There's been ongoing work in consultation with the presidency and other line function departments on the comprehensive public expenditure review, and this was done jointly with the intergovernmental relations and the budget office. The next sub-program is the intergovernmental relations, which looks at provinces and local government, provincial and local government expenditure. In the year under review, a provincial budget and expenditure review document was published, and this tracked sectoral expenditure in various provinces. The committee would recall that we used to produce this on an annual basis as an intergovernmental fiscal review. We now produce it in alternating years. So this year what would be produced is the local government review. The following year will be again the provincial budget and expenditure review. For the year under review, we had also had to publish provincial and municipal data, and this was done within the set time frames in terms of the PFMA section 32 and the MFMA section 7. We finalized the provincial and local government budget framework in September 2009 and also implemented financial management reforms in 120 provincial departments. This compares to the target that we had set ourselves of 30 provincial departments. This had to be accelerated because of the renewed focus on financial management in government. The director conducts funding compliance assessment in 17 non-delegated municipalities as part of the budget review of these municipalities. There are municipalities that are the responsibilities of the National Treasury in terms of monitoring financial management. These are the ones that we have considered key, and they are monitored from National Treasury. There are others which have been delegated to provincial treasuries, and those are the responsibility of the provincial treasuries, and they would tend to be the smaller municipalities. So all the metros and big local municipalities are monitored from the center. And this year, under the period under review, we also published and tabled a report on municipal over and under expenditure per municipality. We had previously just done this thing as a global figure. But now if you want to know what the spending of each one of the municipalities is, you will be able to go for each municipality and see whether they are overspending or they are underspending on their revenue. The last sub-program of program two has to do with technical and management support. This started as a small unit, very small unit in the treasury doing limited intervention, but over a period of time has become very important as government departments approach the treasury for assistance. So the technical and management support group that continues to provide valuable technical and project management support to a number of departments. And the group is made up of the public-private partnership unit of the National Treasury, the 2010 World Cup unit, which is has wound down now, and we are redeploying the staff to work on infrastructure now. The Infrastructure Development Improvement Program, IDIP, which focuses on the capacity of provinces to deliver infrastructure. The Neighborhood Development Partnership Grant, which is focused on municipality, and the Technical Assistance Unit, which provides project and program support for national departments. So at the end of the financial year, the Technical Assistance Unit, TAU, was supporting 60 projects and had completed 7 such projects. Analysis commenced on 5 tertiary hospitals identified by the National Department of Health as potential PPPs, and we would, during the current period, finalize the feasibility studies with respect to these hospitals. The 2010 FIFA World Cup unit provided support to the Minister and Deputy Minister of Finance. It found itself stretched because they then had to provide support to the Technical Coordinating Committee, which was chaired by the Deputy Minister, and the Interministerial Committee and Organizing Committee with respect to the 2010 FIFA World Cup hosting. Through IDIP, 27 full-time technical assistants were deployed to the 9 provincial education, health and public works department. As you could see, this is a very big program of the Treasury program too. The others are shorter, and we should be able to move quicker from now. Program 3 is the asset and liability management program. The key responsibility of this program is to meet government's borrowing needs. In the period 2009-2010, government borrowing needs were 189.4 billion rand and were comfortably met. The program also worked on the establishment of a development finance institutions council. This is a structure that would provide oversight on our development finance institutions like the Development Bank, the Land Bank, the IDC, and so forth. The program also monitored the weekly issuance of state-owned enterprises, bonds in capital markets, and followed up with SOEs that did not receive full subscriptions of their bonds. So we sort of like running an informal queuing system so that you do not have two state institutions running an auction on the same day. So everyone knows when government runs its own auction, and the SOEs then also notify the treasury when they will likely be in the market. To the extent that the SOEs do not get any full subscription at their auction, we follow that with up to try and identify what the problems are. Because when auctions are undersubscribed, it sometimes gives an indication to you that there might be something that you should worry about, and that helps us to follow up on these issues. The program also provided financial oversight for Schedule 2 and Schedule 3B entities, assisted in reviewing the economic regulation in the electricity and aviation sector, and determined the impact on SOE financial sustainability. During this period, we had reviewed the strategic benchmark strategy, the strategic benchmark portfolio to align our debt portfolio to the risk benchmark of 70-30 split. This is a benchmark that we have set for ourselves that says that our debt portfolio must be 70% fixed. That gives us certainty, and 30% floating rate debt or non-fixed rate debt. And lastly, national and provincial governments were able to save about 3% on borrowing costs by not borrowing from commercial banks. This is done through running what we have called the intergovernmental cash coordination system. So to the extent that there are provinces that are sitting on surplus cash, they deposit it with us. If there are provinces that for a particular month are running short of cash, they can borrow against that cash. And by simply doing that cash management, we were able to save government about 3% of borrowing costs. Program 4 is financial system, financial management and systems. This focuses on the transversal system, and also provides support with respect to monitoring of supply chain management compliance. The program has introduced strategic sourcing principles to 24 national departments and 5 provincial treasuries. We still have work to do with respect to municipalities and constitutional institutions. We have partnered with PANAMA, the Public Admin Leadership Management Agency, to roll out a comprehensive training with respect to strategic sourcing. We have to establish a supply chain management compliance unit in conjunction with the Office of the Accountant General to detect and fight tender-related fraud. So there is monitoring that takes place from the program, and I have talked earlier about the specialized audit service unit. So to the extent that irregular things are picked up here, they are referred to those forensic units. The forensic unit also then is able to deal with issues referred to them by other government structures. We have released for public comment draft interim measures to align preferential procurement with the aims of the BBBE Act and its related strategy. There has been a rollout of 13 modules of the integrated financial management systems that are now underway in lead site. The National Treasury and the Limpopo Provincial Treasury have implemented the asset management modules as the lead site, and from now on we'll be able to roll to the other government departments. Other modules are to follow, although we still have challenges experienced due to the turnaround strategy at CETA that has not been fully implemented. And lastly, this program, we have renewed 30 of the 32 transversal term contracts that were due for renewal during the year. There are a total of 59 transversal contracts, so the others are still running. Program 5 is financial accounting and reporting. That's the Office of the Accountant General. Developed and published 19 GRAP tools and checklists for use by departments. GRAP is generally recognized accounting practice. A strategy was finalized to align the cash to accrual implementation plan with the integrated financial management system rollout plan. So, whereas we might have run ahead and tried to implement the accrual accounting system, it is no point if the financial management system is not ready to accommodate it. So now we have synchronized that so that there will be an easy alignment. We publish monthly statements of actual revenue and expenditure for the National Revenue Fund every last working day of each month. And we also provide, this program provides training. It trains 1,334 officials to provide support to provincial treasuries so that they could prepare provincial consolidated financial statements and provincial revenue fund statements. And the program also conducted internal audit reviews at 26 municipalities as planned in terms of the strategic plan. And lastly, assessed financial management skills of 7,496 officials from 283 municipalities. We've developed a tool that we called the financial management capability model. So we use that model to assess the capability of various officials and see whether they are up to the task. Program 6 is the last policy division of the Treasury. The first sub-program is the one on tax and financial sector policy. The program has contributed to discussions in the G20 and Financial Stability Board, primarily with respect to financial sector policy. We have moved away, given the high levels of supervision in South Africa. We have moved away from just complying with international financial standards towards actively assist in shaping what future standards should look like, given the experience that we have. So this division has been very busy. They are almost living in aeroplanes trying to shape this global standards. We've also reviewed the effectiveness of the financial regulatory system in South Africa in collaboration with key financial regulators. What we basically said here is that we can't rest on our laurels. Yes, we have got a well-regulated financial sector, but we always have to ask ourselves the question, isn't there something that we are missing, hence the review that we had. Published for comment a framework to modernize Regulation 28 of the Pension Funds Act, which had been going for some time. Now we have got a framework out there. And also reviewed the strategy to effectively tax financial instruments, limit tax avoidance, and create a level playing field for the tax treatment of debt and equity. Proposals for this were included in the 2010 budget. Sub-program 2 of this focuses on international and regional economic policy. Key outputs this year included the approval of the legal structure to establish the SADC, Southern African Development Community's Project Preparation and Development Facility. And there have been various policy briefs that have been compiled for the Southern African Customs Union, for SADC itself, and for the African Development Bank. We completed the ratification of the agreement for the Collaborative Africa Budget Reform Initiative. We are punching above our weight and have been asked to to co-chair two working groups of the G20, one on the international financial institutions reform, focused particularly on the reform of the International Monetary Fund, and one on growth and development. I think that by far the most important output during the year under review had been the program's involvement in securing the $3.75 billion World Bank loan to enable ESCOM's infrastructure investment program. And lastly, we have increased cooperation and coordination with other emerging markets and developing countries on issues such as the reform of the Bretton Woods institutions and modalities of G20 engagement. The last sub-program of this division is economic policy. This is the division where forecasts for the budget and the MTBPS are done. And with this year, the year under review, we had improved the quality of our macroeconomic forecast for medium-term expenditure framework. We have got now a well-developed policy focus for macroeconomic chapters in both the MTBPS and the budget review. And last year, or at the time of the budget, for the first time, we produced a chapter on employment trends in South Africa. And we have had to do a number of econometric modeling on a range of issues varying from structural budget balance, the Gini coefficient and employment, the impact of the World Cup, and so forth. The new policy analysis and advice on the G20 mutual assessment process, the drivers of rent volatility, the impact of export taxes on the economy, growth enhancing policies, the youth wage subsidies, and so forth. And in addition, this division has to have a series of meetings with domestic and international investors to communicate South Africa's economic policy thinking, and also communicate trends that we see with respect to the domestic economy. Also, a number of meetings with multilateral institutions. That completes the policy programs of the Treasury. The programs 7, 8, and 9 are transfer programs. They are basically primarily fiscal transfers. I will not dwell into this thing. There is a transfer for provincial and local government. It takes place from this program. Program 8 is the civil and military pensions, the GEPF accounts separately to Parliament. And Program 9 is international fiscal transfers, mainly to multilateral development banks and other international bodies. Program 1 is administration. This is the department's support office, which provides corporate services, communications, internal audits, legal services, and security services to other programs in the Treasury. Just a few highlights. The vacancy rates have been reduced to 8% in the Treasury. It established an enterprise risk management unit, which developed a comprehensive ERM strategy, including fraud prevention and so forth. And we have successfully completed risk assessment for 70% of the department. To also run a successful leadership and training program, so we come to the conclusion that if we do not develop leadership inside the Treasury itself, we are not going to get these leaders from elsewhere. And we have exceeded the target here in terms of the average training days per annum per employee. There was a project that we ran, which basically a paper trail, a project that just helped us to track documentation. In terms of the national treasury profile for the 2009-10 financial year, we of the total staff complement, we 56% of the staff are female, 78% of the staff are black, and at a senior management level, we have got 66% of the staff being black and 42% being female. So we have got a fairly a diverse staff complement. In terms of the financials, we do have an unqualified audit, as you would expect from the Treasury, but that's just a blemish. We have an amount of 2.7 million rand that has been categorized as irregular expenditure. It relates to the financial year 2008-2009 and does not relate to the year under review, but it has been recorded as such due to the late extension of a contract of employment agencies that were providing short-term contract staff. The committee would remember that in the previous years we had said that we were using temporary staff to hold in where we have vacancies, and this related to that. It was something that the staff in the HR should have simply put on a memo and requested the DG to condone that while they are going out on tender, the contract should continue. They didn't do that, but in order to avoid interruption of service provision on existing assignments, they allowed the contract to continue. On completion of new contracts, there was, as I said, that oversight from the line function staff. The matter was investigated and appropriate corrective actions recommended, including the training of line function staff on SDM processes and PFMA regulations. We attended to focus training for supply chain management on the people who are running with supply management, supply chain management. But as it turns out, you actually need to take this thing across the department so that even the people who are not running with supply chain management actually understand how the process works. It makes the work of the people in supply chain management easy. We could also say categorically that no employee personally benefited from this. There was no finance loss to the state resulting from the occurrence, and that controls have been reviewed and tightened to detect and or prevent such a recurrence in the future. We just thought that we should bring this to your attention because it is unusual for this to happen in the Treasury.
If you are not looking at the back, probably there should be a thank you there.
From here, Chair.
Okay. Thank you, DG, for your elaborate presentation. In our earlier discussions, honorable members, with the minister and the team, we thought it would be important that we take the two presentations, and then when we do the discussions, we interact with both the presentation from SARS and National Treasury at the same time. And I think that will be in order. Commissioner, you ready? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. And also, let me extend my greetings to the honorable members and the Chair of the Select Committee, Mr. Nubier, to my Minister, Mr. Gordon, and everybody that is here, including the members of the media and the public, and take this also this opportunity to thank you for giving us the opportunity to present our annual report for 2009-2010 financial year. And I must note that, you know, before I could come here and plead, you know, that I'm a new commissioner, the year under review, it's a year that I was fully a commissioner in that year. So I cannot plead ignorance or any other thing. So, honorable members, my presentation will take the following format. The things that I will touch on, I'll introduce my team. The minister has already given the context, the economic context under which the year under review happened. I'll also touch on a significant report that we have in our report, which is the increase in the debt book I will also touch on the cost of collection. How much does it cost us as South African Revenue Service to do our job? I will also then touch the most important thing, which is have we made any gains on the compliance side of our business? And then also on the service improvements that we have gained through our modernization program. And I will also then touch on what have we achieved in our customs and border management, and more importantly, what progress have we made in our collaboration with other state departments. And then I will touch, as the DG did, on the human resource trends in SARS, our governance gains, which is what the DG touched in terms of the AG's report, and finally some of the key achievements that we have done. So, honorable members, let me begin by introducing my team. On my right here, I've got the deputy, on my left, sorry, I've got the deputy commissioner, Mr. Ivan Pile, who oversees our governance, enforcement, and risk, and business enablement divisions. And then in my back somewhere, they will raise their hands as I call their names. It's Mr. Kusilo, who is the head of the legal and policy and policy. And then we also have Mr. Barry Hall, our Chief Operations Officer, El Sipule, our Chief Human Resource Officer, and of course Mr. Jean Ravele, our Chief Officer of Customs and Border Management, and our Chief Financial Officer, Trix Kutsier. And we also have Joseph Rock, who is the head of the Large Business Center, but also acting as Chief of Segmentation. And then there are other five members of our leadership that have accompanied us. Mr. Pete Richard, who is the Executive for Program Management. Mr. Marco Grinelli. Yeah. Oh, he's not. Oh, he's there, yeah. Well, his background is, you know, is from people who disappear, you know. We also have Mr. Adrian Liquet, our spokesperson, and Andrew Fisher, who is our person on the ground, as the DG said, is our parliamentary liaison head, and then Giorgio Radeshi, our head of governance, and the head of the company, and also the company secretary. So, honorable members, the minister has already touched and reflected on the economic conditions that prevailed during the year under review. 2009 and 10 was one of the most difficult and challenging financial years in the history of SARS. I would also like to inform you of the inextricable link between, you know, the revenue collection and the economic conditions. Quite simply, honorable members, economic growth and expansion comes with economic growth and expansion, obviously comes revenue growth. With economic contraction comes revenue contraction. In this regard, it's pretty clear that of the prevailing economic downturn experienced during 2009-2010, it's reflected in the slide on our revenue performance in that year, as reported in the annual report. We showed that year on year, in overall revenue of 26.4 billion, and there was a revenue decline of 26.4 billion, which was the first revenue decline in 13 years in the history of SARS. So it shows how difficult the year it was. And then the only improvement that we have seen in that year, in 2009-10, was collections from personal income tax, which was buffered significantly by above inflationary wage increases. The fuel levy and the excise duty showed year-on-year gains, but these were not enough to offset significant declines in corporate income tax, and that decline in corporate income tax, honorable members, was around 30.2 billion rand, or 18%. which showed the ravages of the economic downturn in that year. That also declined, consumption went down. That went down by 4%, which is around 6.4 billion rand. And custom duties also showed a huge decline of 14% compared to the previous year, which to the amount of 3.2 billion rand. In response, as the minister mentioned, from a SARS point of view, we identified a number of necessary special initiatives to enable us achieving our target. These initiatives with the dedicated SARS workforce were a key factor in helping us to exceed the revised revenue target by 8.4 billion rand. So let me go and touch in the next slide, as you can see, on the debt book. Honorable members, as shown in the slide, you can see that the economic condition also took their toll on the debt book, which grew by 23% year on year to 85.8 billion rand in 2009-2010. For the same period, it needs to be noted that the credit book declined by 7.3%, down from 45.5 billion in 2008 to 42.2 billion in 2009. And remember, the credit book is a reflection of payments to SARS, which have not yet been allocated. This increase in debt, and I want to spend a few seconds on the debt book so that we get the context right. This increase in debt is part of a reflection of the difficult economic circumstances in which taxpayers, both the corporate and individuals, found themselves during 2009-2010. Which significantly affected their ability to pay on time, and in some cases, to pay at all. Much publicity has been given to similar trends which have been experienced, as we know, and reported by financial institutions and tax authorities all over the world. At the same time, the economic conditions over the last 18 months have accentuated the challenges we face in both debt and account maintenance across multiple tax types. Multiple periods and multiple systems, because we have different systems for different tax types. And it needs to be noted, honorable members, that we process over 2 million journal entries each year to update, rectify, and adjust payments across the various tax types and payment periods. So we have to do over 2 million journal entries. And where this adjustment relates to prior payments, as they frequently do, this has a ripple effect on all payments thereafter, as it can affect penalty and interest calculations also. This makes it very difficult, for both staff and taxpayers, especially employers, to reconcile the annual payments. A significant portion of the debt listed each year is ultimately offset against the credit book once allocated payments are correctly identified. And as I mentioned, the credit book for the year under review was sitting at 45.5 billion rand. In the cash accounting system, which we are currently in use in SARS, this discrepancy has not materially impacted on revenue collection. But as part of our preparation for a move to accrual accounting in 2012, we are working on a significant improvement for the account payment and the debt processing as part of our modernization program. Already significant gains, honorable members, have been made in providing individual taxpayers with statement of accounts on demand. The redesign of our pay-as-you-earn submission, reconciliation, and payment processes, and the expanded use of our e-filing, which has provided taxpayers with far more control over their own tax payments than ever before. I'm sure if you have ever went into our e-filing system, you can get your statement in on time. Really, the debt book shows that there are a lot of, you know, allocation issues that needs to be done, which are really a facing issue. Over the next 2 years, we plan to go even further towards a system in line with the modern banking, in which taxpayers are in control of their accounts, payments, and transfers. We should significantly reduce both the credit and the debt books. We believe this process will also necessitate a review of the current debt rights of policy to remove unrecoverable debt. But we'll come to you for any other policy change that we will need when it comes to debt write-off. So, ladies and gentlemen, the decline in the revenue collection also resulted in a slight increase in the cost of collection, which is the next thing on the slide, which rose from a steady 1% level over the past three financial years to 1.2% in 2010. And this percentage is 1% and 1.2. It's a percentage of the revenue collected. So the cost of collecting this revenue is 1%. In the year under review, it rose to 1.2%. And this ratio remains highly efficient and is equitable to many comparative revenue administrations globally, as you can see in the slide, as reflected in the slide that I pointed out to. And we believe that this is a very efficient ratio. It is anticipated that as revenue collection rebounds over the coming years and efficiency gains of our programs are further realized, this ratio, we believe, will revert back to around 1%. Let me touch now, honorable members, on what have been our compliance gains over the year under review. For obvious reasons, in terms of recessions, are usually associated with a decline in compliance. One of the more positive gains achieved during 2009-2010 year was a marked improvement in compliance, especially in terms of returns submitted when it comes to filing compliance. The slide shows that by the end of tax season 2009, SARS had received more than 3.1 million returns compared to 2.4 million returns a year earlier in 2008-2009, reflecting a growth in the filing compliance ratio to 79% compared to 58% in 2008. Equally encouraging, honorable members, is the growing trend by taxpayers to submit their returns early. It took just 8 weeks in 2009 tax season to reach 1 million submissions. By the same point in 2008, only 427,000 returns have been submitted. This year we have seen this trend towards early filing continue, and we must note that we are still in the filing season, and I hope honorable members will remember that the closing date is the end of November. We are watching. This year we have seen the trend towards the filing. It took just 7 weeks to reach this year, 1 million mark this year. And 3 months into the tax season, we have received over 2.2 million returns compared to 1.8 million by the same stage last year, which reflects a 22% increase in on-time filing. We believe that years of laying a strong foundation for tax morality, coupled with the introduction of an effective new penalty regime and a significant improvement in risk detection provided by third-party data and other sources as part of our modernization program, is starting to bear fruit at exactly the time that it is needed the most to drive compliance. And that is some of the things that have helped us to make all the other gains that you did during a very difficult year. The slide that is on shows that during 2009-10, SARS issued more than 270,000 penalty notices to taxpayers with multiple outstanding returns, resulting in the submission of over 80,000 late returns. This has been followed up in the past few weeks with the issuing of over 60,000 IT88 agent appointment notices to recover outstanding penalties from defaulting taxpayer salaries. If you remember, we warned in October last year that if you don't heed the very kind and, goodwill gestures that we were giving taxpayers, we will go to your salaries and bank account to recover this thing. So we have issued 60,000 of those agent appointment notices to recover the money. We have also clamped down on fraudulent VAT claims through a focused effort to remove bogus VAT vendors and to tighten up on VAT regulations to ensure legitimate access to the VAT system. This saw, honorable members, some 16,000 VAT vendors suspended during the year. The sophisticated risk engines, expanded use of third-party data, and the reorganization of compliance processes has allowed us to expand our audit and verification coverage for tax returns, which increased by over 50%, from just over 70,000 audits to almost 160,000 audits last year, resulting in additional revenue of approximately 1.3 billion rand. So this modernization and our updating of our systems has really created the capacity for us to be able to do more audits. A 50% increase in audit capability is a significant achievement, we believe. Honorable members, a credible threat of detection and enforcement for those who fail to meet their obligation is an essential ingredient for a fair and an equitable tax system. And we plan to further expand the use of administrative penalties, third-party data, and risk detection for those who continue to skirt their obligations. So the numbers that we are giving you, because before, as you know, many people didn't believe that we have the capability to do what we have done. We are now saying we are planning to expand the systems to be able to get to those that are skirting their obligations. There is no place to hide. This has helped us on the enforcement side, honorable members, to have far better targeted interventions, which has led to seizures of illicit and counterfeit goods, including the following, and then I highlight that the slide is not very clear. 560 loan checks to the value of 7.8 million were seized in the year under review. 67 million cigarettes to the value. I mean, 67 million cigarettes is a lot of cigarettes. To the value of 33 million were seized. Two warehouses of alcohol and three plants, illegal manufacturing plants, were closed down. We also seized 340,000 DVDs worth around 53 million, 35 tons of textile, different kinds of textile, tons of textile, that's a lot of drugs, were also seized, and 400 seizures of narcotics with a street value of 280 million were also seized under the year in review. We have also, honorable members, have contacted the 881 investors who are South Africans, who are South African taxpayers in the Ponzi scheme, and I see the financial mail reported this morning on it. And it should be remembered, honorable members, that Ponzi schemes are illegal. And any earnings that are earned out of that will ultimately be surrendered to the state, because it's an illegal, not just we'll tax them, but, you know, the earnings themselves are illegal, and they need to be seized by the state. On the service improvement side, honorable members, we've also seen a lot of gains. We continue to deliver against our target and expectation on the service, on our service charter, which we embarked on in 2007. The key initiatives initially aimed at transforming the income tax process from a complex paper-based and labor-intensive process to a very simplified and automated process has delivered great strides, and we have done this through our modernization program. This endeavor has not only reduced costs for both SARS and the taxpayer, but it has also gone a long way towards strengthening our compliance aspect, as I mentioned earlier. As you can see on the slide, over the past 3 years, the number of registered e-filing users have increased from 500,000 at the end of 2006 to over 6 million users at the end of 2009-2010 tax year. This is a 12-fold increase. Usage of this channel has increased substantially, with the number of electronic returns submitted increasing approximately at the rate of 1.5 million per annum in 2006 to approximately 10.8 million at the end of March 2010, resulting in an increase of 720% across all income tax types and products. Following the learnings that we have had from the pre-populated employee IRP5 information initiative used in previous years, 2010 saw significant improvement in this process. As a result, reconciliations between staff and employers have become less complicated, while at the same time it assists in tracing and collecting outstanding debt. This improvement, ladies and gentlemen, has helped significantly to improve the turnaround times for the assessment of returns, with almost 95% of returns processed within 24 hours during the tax season of 2009, compared to 62% a year earlier. In the vast majority of these cases, this has resulted in refunds being paid within 48 hours of submission directly into the taxpayer's bank accounts. During this year, honorable members, we have refunded, contrary to many beliefs, 14.8 billion compared to 11.2 billion a year earlier, providing a significant and speedy relief to cash-strapped consumers. During the past 3 years, SARS has also invested significantly on the customer service program. To date, considerable progress has been made in this program. We have continued movement towards improved customer service, resulting from an integrated and virtual contact centers, improved transactional workflow, optimized infrastructure and facilities. We enhanced staff learnings and delivery of self-help offerings also improved. In the final budget speech, if honorable members remember, the Minister of Finance in February last year, Minister Trevor Manuel highlighted the challenge we had in providing an excellent service to taxpayers and traders through the SARS call center. And he noted that at that time, the call centers would be deemed dysfunctional. I'm pleased to report that we have taken the criticism to heart and worked tirelessly to improve our call center performance over the past year. Our annual report, as you have seen, notes an improvement of over 10% in calls answered within 20 seconds to 63%. And I'm pleased to report that during last week's deadline peak for manual income tax return submissions, we answered over 80% of all calls within 20 seconds. These improvements are not going unnoticed. A year or two back, we received from the famous financial mail call center rating page, we received a 0 out of 5 in the weekly FinWeek call center rating. In September this year edition, in the September 30th edition of FinWeek, we received 4 out of 5, and the calls were answered within 30 seconds. So it shows the amount of progress that we have made in the last year in improving our call center efficiencies. We know that we are not there yet, and many improvements can and will still be made. But I think we can definitely say that the call centers are not as dysfunctional as they used to be about 2 years ago. There are many other modernization initiatives, including improvement to customs processes, VAT, and corporate income tax, which are described in more detail in the annual report, which I will not touch on. This renewals of SARS is driving significant business benefits for all stakeholders, honorable members, including taxpayers, traders, and practitioners, clearing agents and others who represent them. As the modernization journey continues, it aims not only to reduce the administrative burden through simplifying and automating the entire process and increasing the speed and accuracy of processing and service, but we also are looking at improving the ability to detect and deter noncompliance. This is translating into fiscal rewards and a more even spread of the tax burden. We acknowledge in SAF that there's still some way to go in this journey, but we are very confident that by pursuing it consistently, steadily, in a results-oriented approach, as we adopted it 3 years ago, many benefits are still to be extracted from future modernization efforts. Let me now touch on the progress that we have made or the results of our performance in customs and border management. On the customs and border management side, honorable members, our business saw a year of intensive background work in preparing for the custom modernization program, which was launched by our minister in October last year. This program will address 5 aspects of the supply chain as reflected on the slide, namely the concept of a trusted trader in which preferential treatment will be provided to registered traders who have proven themselves to be compliant. Secondly, we will seek to enhance our risk detection through third-party data and the use of risk engines to better target customs intervention and inspection. Thirdly, honorable members, as previously reported, we in SAF took the bold step of buying a local software development company to secure the intellectual property for an advanced integrated customs and border management system, which is already in use in Luxembourg and which we believe has the potential to provide a platform for our modernization initiative and for other customs administrations in the region and indeed globally. Already Lesotho and Swaziland have indicated their interest in acquiring the same system. The benefits of buying the company have been to significantly reduce the risk and to provide SAS with internal competencies in this highly specialized area. In addition, any future gains for the implementation of this system elsewhere will be used to offset the purchase price and an ongoing cost of implementation. I touched and said I will touch you very quickly on the collaboration with other government institutions. As you know, we had the collaborative product that we put together with the Department of Home Affairs to try and make sure that the movement of movement control of people during the World Cup will be successful. The collaboration has culminated in the ongoing work. Honorable members of the steering committee compromising of all significant role players in the border management and protection, which is pursuing, as you know, the border management agency initiative as announced by the president last year. In addition, there's an enhanced and continuously improving working relationship with a wide variety of state institutions, as evidenced by our collaboration with the JCPS, international cooperation and trade clusters and the governance clusters. And then we also participate in the multi-agency working group in the same year, the roundtable of the financial state institution, which is chaired by the Treasury. And then let me just touch quickly on the HR improvement that we have had in the year under review. On the people front, SAF headcount reduced very marginally during 2009-2010 compared to the previous financial year, with a total of 14,738 permanent employees and 525 temporary employees. This was 44 people less than the previous year. Encouragingly, as depicted in the slide, as you can see, we continue with our upward trend of employment equity, with increases in the number of black employees and women, including in the supervisory and management field. You can see that we're sitting at around 66% blacks, 67% women, and an improvement of around 66% of previously disadvantaged people in management. And we've seen a very encouraging increase of a representation of black people in senior management. And then let me now touch on the issues of governance. Honorable members, you are pleased to report that the Auditor General, who I see is at the back here, Mr. Eugene, we are pleased to report that the Auditor General has given SARS an unqualified audit report for the year 2009-2010. This is the sixth in a row, which reflects our ongoing dedication and commitment to good governance. In the interest of full disclosure, let me highlight, taking cue from my comrade, the DG, let me highlight the one emphasis of matter, which the Auditor General noted, which relates to the impairment of the loan of Clydet LTD. Clydet, as I mentioned, is the name of the company wholly owned by SARS, which was established as part of the acquisition of the customs software, as reported on in last year's annual report. The loan was required to be impaired, as Clydet will be supported by SARS for their cash flow, as the customs and border management system is further developed and implemented as part of our customs modernization. There remains obviously potential for future marketing of this system internationally. In fact, as I mentioned, Lesotho and Swaziland recently has already expressed an interest in utilizing this system, but the company is unlikely to be self-funding in the near future. Honorable members, for us, an unqualified audit is much more than a mere governance requirement and a fulfillment of our financial responsibility. The accountability, we believe, of public institutions and the faith the public has in them is a key ingredient in the social contract that between taxpayers and the state, and is a direct contributor to a greater compliance environment. For us, therefore, it's a mark of our values of integrity, honesty and fairness, and trust. So let me conclude by just mentioning quickly our key achievement this year, honorable members, and allow me to break a little bit on a number of key achievements that we have done in the year under review. The first of this is the launch of the African Tax Administration Forum in Uganda last year. SARS pioneered ATEF and now chairs the forum, having already attracted over 30 African countries as members out of the 53 or 52 African nations that we have. This forms the basis for a closer cooperation and engagement between revenue authorities on the African continent. South Africa will host, we will host ultimately once the protocols have been done, the secretariat. In addition, SARS will continue to play a key role in a number of international multilateral tax and customs forums, including the OECD Forum for Tax Administration, the World Customs Organization. Secondly, SARS was also, honorable members, awarded top honors in the inaugural Public Service Excellence Awards in October 2009. We got the Grand Prize Platinum Award for Best Reputation of All Government Departments and State-Owned Enterprises. We also received other awards like the Lean Institute African Diamond Award for Excellence. In conclusion, therefore, honorable members, the prevailing conditions during the financial year 2009 presented SARS with its tenuous test yet, the strong foundation laid and foresight of the leadership of this organization over the past 10 years has enabled the organization to navigate these conditions with relative stability and certainty and confidence. Our work in meeting our mandate through improved compliance, enhanced service, and fair and firm enforcement is no means over. We will, nor will it ever be, for there will always be room for improvement, always new goals, and always higher performance expected of us by ourselves and others who wish our country to succeed. I remain confident, honorable members, that SARS has the people, the passion, and the patriotism to meet these challenges. I thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable Minister, do you want to make a...
May I request, Chairperson, that if there's any questions directly for me, that we take those first. I want to leave in the next 10 or 15 minutes. And then my two bosses on either side can handle the rest of the questions.
See, I was going to propose that we have a 5 to 10 minutes comfort break before. But I think if there are questions that honorable members would want to be directed to the minister, let's do that quickly so that we can get asked to be released earlier on. I did not forward that apology in advance. If those questions cannot be answered by anybody else in the team, so that we don't open discussions forever.
No, it's right. Not a question. I was just pleading that he cannot be released because he's sick.
It's a great sympathy with you, for you, Mr. Minister. But Honorable John George will not let you go. I am certain about that. John, you'll be followed by Honorable Munzisi, Mr. Van Rooyen, Des, and then Luyenge. These are the only four hands that I'm taking for this, for the purposes of the minister to respond to. The rest will go to the rest of the team later on. Thank you. John?
Thank you, Chairperson, and I do apologize, Minister, for detaining you for a short while, but I'll only ask you very short.
This is what I get paid for.
I do have sympathy for your for your condition.
Can you switch off your mic? We don't want to be over-text.
Minister, you mentioned the quality of the outcome of the spend of the public money. We've now seen a public sector strike and seen the wage settlement of about 7.5%, which is above the inflation rate, without productivity increases. Are you going to change this cycle that doesn't seem to be very beneficial to our economy? And secondly, what is the National Treasury's view on the settlement? And then, during the debates on the taxation laws in September, you mentioned, or it was raised, the issue of increased complexity in the tax laws, or perceptions of complexity in the tax laws, and you responded that proposals for a tax commission would be expensive and suggested that perhaps we could engage in a series of workshops or something to look at this issue. How and when can this process be initiated? Thank you, Chairperson.
Pardon?
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, my question is on Program 8. I would really appreciate the Minister to be here when this question is asked, because it is something that has been dealt with for quite a number of years in other committees. The issue of the special pension and the non-statutory forces. Now, the rationale behind the special pension dispensation for non-statutory forces is such that what government wanted to do and also what finance wanted to provide was a safety net for the non-statutory forces. Most in particular those who were laid off from the existing South African National Defence Force. So the principle is that firstly you have to recognize the full-time engagement that they have made for the contribution in this democracy. And that secondly, you want to create the leveling of the playing field, because we had two contending forces. But now the disparity is that the one force from the SADF, the past SADF, they were full-time combatants in the state, and they had all the benefits, you know, the salary, the pensions, medical aid, housing allowance, etc. But now, with respect to the non-statutory forces, Program 8 here indicates about the means to begin to address, most in particular, the issue of the 35, which is very much welcome, and the publicity around it. But the problem that we have is that the pensions, the special pensions of these combatants is actually taxed. We accept and we understand that the international good practice with respect to income is that all income should be taxed. But with respect to these non-statutory combatants who are not employed currently and who are on the queue of the RDP houses, and we continue to tax them to the same extent which is taxable to all South Africans. And having said this is a special dispensation to cover these non-statutory forces, we actually question the rationale behind the taxing of such a special pension that came under special conditions, which wanted to create a relief for them. But now, my other question also hinges on the NSF pension. With respect to the NSF pension, you have a situation in which members of the non-statutory forces are required to buy back a pension. Now, this buyback scheme of pension, it marginalizes again those who are not employed. It marginalizes those who might be working or those who might be public representatives. But nevertheless, those who can be able to buy back this pension, you know, ministers can be able to buy this pension. Former combatants in business can be able to buy back this pension. But your ordinary public representatives and the unemployed veterans, that is beyond them. They cannot be able to buy back this pension. Now, I just need clarity with respect to any measures of relief that can be put into place to ensure that in future, we have to look comprehensively at a system that will be able to benefit the non-statutory forces. Because when we talk about the SADF of the past, we are quite aware of the packages that they were able to receive when they left their deployment full-time. So all we are saying, Minister, is there a possibility of a review of the non-taxation of special pension and also a review on the NSF pension, because it is beyond the means of any of these combatants to buy it there. Thank you, Chairperson.
That's a special presentation. The Minister will respond to that special presentation. Honorable Van Rooyen, no special presentations. Questions that require the Minister to respond in terms of the presentations that have been here. And Honorable Liang, after, immediately after Van Rooyen. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Let me start by welcoming the two presentations. Chair, I got only one question to the Minister. It has been brought to the attention of the committee on several occasions, but also it is revealed in the report that there are criminal matters that are referred to SAPS. It's picked up by investigations, of course, conducted by the minister. I think the million-dollar question is around the improvement of continuous cooperation between National Treasury and the law enforcement agents, because it is very apparent that some of these cases, in fact, most of the cases do not come to a logical conclusion because of lack of this cooperation. I'm not sure if there are any measures that are being considered by the ministry to ensure that there is continuous cooperation between National Treasury and law enforcement agencies. So if cases that are of this nature that are referred, I mean, to law enforcement agencies by the ministry, are brought to appropriate and logical conclusion. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, mine is on issues of procurement. Treasury has, on a number of occasions, pronounced on issues that are unsettling the government of South Africa around corruption. There is naked corruption rotten to the core departments across the sphere. What is the view of Treasury in terms of addressing these issues, which have been prevailing most so in this current financial year, after the pronunciation by the ruling party of the five priorities? But what is taking place now is totally contradictory to what has been pronounced by the ruling party, the African National Congress. Then secondly, Treasury, the report of the accounting officer has reflected on the challenge of reviewing the service delivery model. So what then is the problem around there? Because if you don't review that model, it means we cannot measure the rate and level of service delivery. Thank you.
Minister, over to you. Follow-up questions, honorable members, will be taken by Treasury representatives after the ministers left. I just wanted to make that clear, that National Treasury still won't be part of this meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Dr. George. The quality of outcome is something that every government in the world addresses. So particularly when you have fiscal constraints, the issue of value for money and better quality of outcomes for the money spent is something that all governments will be looking at, including ourselves. Now certainly the challenge, and we've said this repeatedly, for us in government is to what extent do we want to continue to increase the wages of current public servants, and to what extent do we want to employ new public servants, particularly in frontline service delivery areas like nursing, doctors, teachers, etc. Now, it's a simple equation, if you like, that if we continue to increase current benefits for current workers, we crowd out future employment. But there's a second trend, and that's linked to Luenga's question naturally as well, which is that attention must also be given to, in government, to hiring too many people in a bloated administrative section of delivery departments versus the delivery side. So that's a trend as well that's worrying at the moment. And in particular, some provinces are guilty of these practices and of lack of control over the numbers that are hired on the administrative side. So we find that, I don't want to go into details now, but there are provinces that have employed literally thousands of people on the administration side and neglected the service delivery side, so to speak. Now, if we continue to have these imbalances and continue to have wrong people employed in the wrong places and with a lack of skills, and that's what affects the service delivery model, if you like, ultimately, then we're going to continue to shoot ourselves in the foot. Now, what are we going to do about it? Well, I think we need to first be frankly and openly talk about the trade-off between continuous increased benefits for current workers and the necessity to employ service delivery personnel who are properly qualified and trained in the public service as well. Secondly, we need to acknowledge that certain sections of the public service have challenges, particularly in relation to housing and so on,
because of the structure of the housing market in South Africa and the structure of the financial markets as well. But we've made a commitment there as the Department of Public Service and Administration, ourselves, the Department of Human Settlements, to sit together with the trade unions and see if we can begin to find extraordinary solutions, if you like, outside of the box in this particular regard. On the taxation laws and complexity, I know that this is a popular call. Again, it happens A, repeatedly in South Africa, but B, elsewhere in the world as well. But at some stage, Chair, you might have a workshop with Kosi Low and Ismail Momoniat and others, and so that we can go into more patiently what are the commercial challenges and what are the commercial trends that are occurring now that require particular responses in terms of tax policy. In other words, you don't just cook this thing up out of nowhere. There are specific phenomena that are occurring, like transfer pricing, for example, or there are particular arrangements which could result in the tax base of South Africa being diluted by particular kinds of company practices and structuring and so on. And remember that and I think I've said this before, Dr. George, and you've heard it, that the creative industry on the other side that we deal with. This is not about arts and performance now. This is about tax planning and tax structuring. Is extremely well resourced. And no tax administration in the world is equipped to in any way have a fair balance with people working on the so-called creative side of this industry. And that's the imbalance. That's where these fora that the Commissioner speaks about are so vital, because they help us to use our minimum resources, share information, and come up with either collective answers or individual answers based on benchmarking with others and try to combat these let's call them unhelpful innovations that people actually engage in. Do we need a commission? We're still thinking about that, and much of our basic pillars of our tax policy are in place, where you will find new debates beginning to emerge, and some of this work has been done, and there are discussion papers that will come out into the public domain shortly around environmental taxes, for example. So the Treasury has done some work in these areas, and pretty soon the committees will be asked to engage with that. And perhaps Mr. Momoniat and Mr. Lowe and others can think about what are the nature of the workshops that we could still have, which brings to the fore, if you like, current trends in tax policy. And in particular, tax policy as it relates to some of our national objectives. So what kind of tax policy promotes better growth? What kind of tax policy ensures better redistribution within the South African context? What kind of tax policy promotes investment, particularly in infrastructure and in plants and so on, in the private sector? Now, South Africa is not running short of channels through which tax expenditure is already occurring, whether it's the MIDP and its successor or other forms of tax expenditure. So at some stage, we also need to take account of what's all the tax expenditure that the state is engaging in other words, money that we're losing, through incentives that are already in place. And if we want different incentives, then we've got to target them better, but also close up some of the incentives so that the money can be redirected in a different way, particularly in support of the industrial policy action plan and similar endeavors to promote manufacturing and job creation in South Africa. Mr. Mansisi, as the chairman pointed out, this is a special pleading. I'm just going to say two things. One is that the special pensions dispensation for the non-statutory forces is under discussion in government. I'm not in a position to say anything publicly about that, but after the meeting, the DG will explain to you what is going on. And we have every commitment to leveling the playing field, financial resources actually permitting. I think we must also, then, this is the second thing, agree that in the early days of the special pensions regime, mistakes were made by individuals. We took too much of money, we spent money in the wrong kind of way, and people find themselves in some kind of difficulty as a result. So the whole issue of buying back pension and so on is also part of a discussion at the moment, and perhaps, Chairperson, with your consent, after the meeting or during the break, we can explain where these processes are going. But we have every sympathy for what you are raising. The Honourable Van Rooyen, about investigations and so on, let me give you a general answer now, and perhaps after the tea break, we can, the Accountant General and Mr. Pillay can tell you about some of the constraints they face, so you put your finger on the right spot. That we've got to get a more efficient value chain operating from investigation to landing up in jail. And at the moment, that the connection is there, but it's not as efficient as it should be, as you correctly point out. Now, numerous efforts are being made to expedite this, but also alternatives are being developed. So you would have heard the Minister of Public Service and Administration saying that there's a new anti-corruption unit, but essentially the focus of that unit is to not allow for public servants who've been caught red-handed and against whom there's evidence, and they have been suspended, to be suspended forever. That there is a very expeditious process through which they brought before a disciplinary committee, go through the disciplinary processes, and the current position where you can be dragged on for 6 months to 2 years or 3 years and on full pay is something that's untenable and will now stop as a result of those measures that will be in place shortly. So there are other alternatives that are also being developed to ensure, and this links again to the Honourable Member's point around corruption, that we need more efficient systems, and I think we're getting there, to deal with identified corruption. So if I can shift to the final point about, and we share the Honourable Member's concerns about corruption being a cancer, and that if we don't act as it happens when you don't detect the cancer early, is when you end up with what they call stage 4 cancer, and then there's no hope for you. Now, hopefully, we're nowhere near stage 4 as far as the cancer of corruption is concerned. But it's very important that honourable members and structures like this committee take a very forceful stand, and publicly so, on this question, because the voices, the open voices, opposing corruption are not loud enough, and there aren't many enough. So we can't just leave it to the investigators and so on to carry this particular burden. And the more we can have an open discourse and a public engagement and get the message of our people involved in that, the better for all of us. Because ultimately, as you correctly point out, the losers are the ordinary people. So we can say this year, as part of our fiscal picture, we're spending over 800 billion rands in government, much of it borrowed, 170-odd billion rands borrowed, slightly lower now. And you'll get the figures on the 27th of October. But what are we spending the money on? You know, and in how many people's pockets is this actually going? And is it going into the right pockets? All the right questions. I agree with you. Perhaps the DG, after tea, can explain to you what he meant by the service delivery model. But essentially, it's still connected to, are the institutions of government working? Do we have efficient and skilled people in the right kind of position? Are we ensuring that those things that distort delivery, divert money into the wrong hands, and corrupt established procedures, are we allowing that to grow, or are we able to combat it and narrow the terrain on which those things operate? But I'm confident that there's a much louder and more frank engagement around the question of corruption and procurement practices in government, and hopefully around the MTBPS we'll be able to announce a further set of more aggressive measures to ensure that we combat these sorts of practices. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thanks, Minister. And you are relieved. Honorable members, let's take 5 to 10 minutes comfort break and come back. When I come back, Honorable De Beer will then take over to as the chair for the next session, questions and discussions. Thank you for now. Over to you, Mr. Sibir.
Thank you, Co-Chair Mahdi. Honourable members, we thank again the team from Treasury, the Minister leading the team for their presentation, Treasury and SARS. It's time for questions. Can you please raise your hands as we take you? Dr. George, got you. Mrs. Adams. Honourable Adams. Number 3, number 4, Kulachani. Must I remember your number coming up from that side? Number 5, Honourable Kornoff. 6, Honourable Lees. And 7, Honourable Nyenge. Eight. And 9, Mr. Van der Rooy, Honorable Van der Rooy. In that order, you may start.
Thank you.
Introduce yourself to the team there that I note when they reply to your question. We take all the questions and then the reply, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Dion George. Two questions, one for the National Treasury and one for SARS. For the National Treasury, shouldn't there be an additional program, something about consumer protection specifically related to the Financial Services Board? We do have, and the Minister mentioned it before he left, we do have great problems regarding fraud and corruption within our financial systems in South Africa. And who pays? It's the consumer at the end of the day, whether it's a taxpayer or in another scenario. So, for example, we've seen the Guardians Fund that was defrauded of 80 million rand. The Guardians Fund doesn't fit under the FSB. So where do the people turn? So my question is just simply that. Is Treasury looking at a program of some kind that looks specifically at this issue of consumer protection? And then on SARS, you mentioned in your strategic plan on page 28 about broadening the tax base, and there's a target of 2% growth by March 2010. Do you have a specific program or plan that identifies specific intersections of the industry or the economy that you need to focus on to get into the tax net? For example, specifically the taxi industry that apparently notoriously isn't inside the tax net. And do you record new businesses that per sector that are registered? Thank you, Chair.
Adams, your mic, please.
Mine is directed to National Treasury, Patricia Adams speaking, on page 68, on your sub-program on financial systems. You have a number of targets. For example, National Treasury and Limpopo Provincial Treasury have implemented the IFMS system, and you intended to implement it to the Defense, Department of Defense and Limpopo departments. Has this been done? That's the first question. And I'd like you to have some time frame set, as you said in this in the contract system. Framework for contracting is being developed. Proposal to be finalized, awaiting CETA to adopt proposals. Can you give a time frame there? And on the same sub-program, to create a user support capacity at CITES. You intend, the target was to set up a call center and a help desk at CITA, has that been done? And to set up an IFMS training unit at CITA, has that been done? And then on page 110, report of the audit committee, the name of the members are there. And then there is a column on remarks. And most of the members' contract has been expired on the 31st of January 2010. Does that mean that the committee doesn't meet? How do they reach a quorum? And what process is followed in identifying members for this committee? Thank you,
Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. I'm Matt Lamini. The National Treasury indicated to us that they've conducted funding a compliance assessment on the 17 non-dedicated municipalities. And we have also published a report. You tabled that report. That is now in your program number 2. I want to align what you have said in program number 2 with what is on program number 7. Honorable Chairs, I would like the National Treasury to explain to the committee as to when and how is the National Treasury going to start giving us the monitoring tool. Because I've gone through the document, and the monitoring tool of the grants given to the municipalities, it's not there. And it seems like the National Treasury is actually good in funding or transferring funds, but the monitoring thereof is not there. And it worries, especially when we approach the local election. Thank you, Chair.
Bill Charney.
Thanks, Chair. My questions are to National Treasury. First, with regard to the infrastructure grant to provinces, I think that particular grant, in terms of the report, was meant for the rehabilitation of existing infrastructure in education, health, and roads, and agriculture. But there seems to be a little report or work reported on in what is being done by provinces in agriculture. Now, the question is it the result of your regulation or is just the plans of the provinces not to use that grant to do some work on agricultural infrastructure? Because even if you look into provincial reports, little is done, despite the fact that there is this particular grant. Again, the grant was increased during the period under review to cover for eradication of mud and inappropriate schools. I want to check if you are satisfied with progress registered in that particular regard. Mainly also taking into consideration that we still have got serious challenges relating to mud schools in rural provinces like KZN and Eastern Cape. And the other reason for the increase on the grant was maintenance of this coal haulage routes. But the reality again is that in towns like in Mpumalanga in particular, you still have got provinces neglecting those routes that are classified as municipal routes. And some of these trucks causes tremendous damage in those particular routes. I would like to hear your views in terms of that, because one would have expected that this grant, if it is to address that particular problem, the province should not only concentrate on those routes that are classified as the routes belonging to provinces, but it should also be extended to those that are classified as routes under municipalities. And the possibility of engaging those mines, particularly at municipality level, to take that particular responsibility, as opposed to making it the responsibility of national treasury. Question number three, in terms of your report on page number 97, under program 7, you under IDIP, you're reporting that there are 6 full-time technical assistants were employed or were deployed or appointed. But in your report, in the slides and in schedule, I mean program 2, the figure is 27, not 36. If you could explain that particular discrepancy and give indication as to how many short-term assistants were appointed to assist this full-time technical assistants. Question number 4, local government financial management grant. One notes what is being reported here, but the reality is that in municipalities, these rural municipalities, I'm sure part of them will be the 32 that you spoke about. You still have got a challenge of this municipality not being able to use this grant to build capacity around financial management and all those other related things that needs to be done through that particular grant. And I think the figures, it would have been, if we were to break down the figure of 894 in terms of those particular graduates, you would realize that a large number, if not the entire figure, goes to the metros and all those other municipalities that are able to raise their own revenue. But those municipalities in the Northern Cape, I think Northern Cape and some parts of the Eastern Cape, we still have a serious challenge in that particular regard. Now, my question there is, what is it that Treasury would be doing going forward to make sure that this whole system of ensuring that there are at least 3 graduate interns in each and every municipality is realized in all 283 municipalities? Because as it is now, if you can go and verify, because I'm tempted to believe that on this one you relied heavily on the reports that you are getting as opposed to actual verification. Because in our visit to these municipalities, the opposite is the case in terms of what is reported here. Now, how do you test or monitor these reports? Do you only rely on reports, or there's a monitoring system in Treasury that seeks to verify some of the reported figures that you receive from this particular municipality? And lastly, Chair, the local government financial management grant. Despite the objectives of that particular grant, you still have got a situation where the four municipalities currently, as at the end of March, in terms of the report, 34 municipalities were not compliant in terms of submission of Section 71 report. 36 municipalities did not submit their financial statements by due date, and 146 could not submit their annual report. And according, if you look into that, the trend, right into the current financial year, that problem still persists, despite the fact that Treasury is trying to help and improve the situation by way of giving this grant. Is there any measures that you are putting in place to make sure that in the current financial year, at least at the end, there is some tremendous improvement in those particular municipalities that are failing to comply with the regulations and the conditions of this particular grant? Thank you, Chair.
Yes, it's a long question of 4 or 5 subsections, but well done. Honorable Kornhoff?
Yeah. Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Nick Kornoff. Just first a question to the Treasury under program number 2, where you stated that you have completed the feasibility study on 6 hospitals. I think you've only started to do work on 2. I would like to know who are the remaining 4 and when will they be completed in this whole debate about national health insurance. Secondly, it appears that some of the contractors working on the triple P's are being paid very late. I don't know whether you're aware of that. Sometimes some of these payments are overdue for more than 12 months. I don't think it's good. I don't think it should be like that if we would like to deliver these projects on time. And then a question to SARS. The queues at the offices are become very long. And, you know, you have to take a day off for a simple inquiry if you go to some of the offices. Now, that's a good sign that the public are responding and that they would like to get their affairs in order. But out of a service delivery point of view, it is really becoming a nightmare.
I believe.
Chairman Alf Lee, question to National Treasury. The Minister and you, DG, have referred earlier to the strength of our banking system during the recent economic crisis. Now, given those comments, yesterday, the DG for Trade and Industry glibly made a statement that there was a need to intervene in the financial sector so that the resources they hold can be released into the economy. Is there any communication taking place between National Treasury and DTI on this issue? Because the implications may be quite severe for our banking sector. The second question is one which I'm not well informed on, and you'll forgive me if I don't get my terminology right. However, in the books of the South African Reserve Bank, there sits a debit balance of some 42 billion, which apparently is a National Treasury guarantee for funds used to increase our national reserves. Now, could you clarify that from a Treasury point of view, whether that's a contingent liability for Treasury? And then to the Commissioner, we had a nice chat at tea, thank you, so a couple of things have been dealt with. However, there is talk in the corridors amongst the professionals in the accounting world that your computer system is not as stable as it could be. Are you able to reassure us that the stability of the system is good and that we're not likely to see anything similar to the Cipro collapse or anywhere near that? My personal experience of your e-filing system is that it's a remarkable system. However, get to declaration day for VAT or any other, you battle to get onto that system. It's a nightmare, and you have to wait until the evening when other people have gone to the club or the pub to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Dr. Nyenge.
Thank you, Chair. Mine is on asset and then liability management. Chair, to determine appropriate capital structure, the department set a target of 33% for the 6 state-owned enterprises for its benchmarking, of which that target was not actually met. And the reason being that the department could not be able to solicit the necessary information from the enterprises, of which one cannot understand that. And there is no alternative remedy to address the perpetuity of the situation. Secondly, on the IFMS, We had a meeting, a joint meeting with the Public Service and Administration Portfolio Committee, when the department was introducing this arrangement of the integrated financial management system, of which we had a number of questions, including a broader consultation on the part of the stakeholders. Now there are problems. Seemingly, it was just a formality that the department consulted the portfolio committees, because now it comes out of this report that there are problems in that process, and it has also affected the setting up of the call center help desk. Lastly, on the financial accounting and reporting, there is maybe a type of error on the National Treasury Strategic Plan, which according to the 2009-12, they recorded 1,600 trainees as the target for that period. And in the current financial year's figures, there is a reflection of 600 trainees. Can that be corrected if cannot be justified? Lastly, generally on the programs, Chair, there is an indication of violence, especially on asset and liability management, on financial management systems, financial accounting and reporting, of which is an indication of high level of budget and planning, where not a single cent was set aside for these sub-programs. And all of a sudden, money is had to be made available for its operations. How is the department going to address that in future? Because it is very important to ensure that financial resources of the department are actually catered for in terms of ensuring that there is money available to ensure that the warm bodies that are there are able to execute their duties. Thank you.
Thank you. Honorable Mandela.
Thank you very much, Chair. A hop on what Dr. Kurinoff has already mentioned about the triple P's. It is good to know that there are now standardized provisions for public comments that have been issued out. I just want to find out how far that revised triple P is right now. The second question is about the ranking of South Africa. We do read that it was at 42 at some state economic ranking, world ranking, and now it's gone down to 82. This is just a question that would help us to understand what could be happening that maybe we are not doing right, or are we right to follow such rankings. The last one is on the coordination of the work that is being done by the Chapter 9 FFC, just to find out whether there is any coordination between that work. Is it of benefit to National Treasury, or is it something that that is totally divorced from what National Treasury is doing? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you once more, Chair. Chair, it's said that in the Treasury report that the infrastructure delivery improvement program has been extended to 2003. Now, understanding that this program was meant to provide technical support to provinces around aspects of infrastructure management, and in the light of the backlog that most of these provinces are still exposed to,
Well, what is the rationale for this extension to be concluded so soon? Or maybe this extension to be, I mean, to be realized on this this year, which in my take is very soon. I don't understand, because I think we still need this particular program beyond 2013. We still have a very huge backlog to address. And also to treasury, a mention was made of obviously under asset and liability management, a national and provincial government saving about 3% on borrowing cost due to surplus that has been picked up within the national department as well as the provincial government. I want to know what are the components of this surplus, but also how is this borrowing process, I mean, realized? I mean, I think it will be very important for one to understand, since it's something that is usually conducted under the commercial banks. How is it done within the national treasures and respective departments? And on the SARS, it's cited in this report of SARS that there was an accusation of the custom management solution system to the tune of what is this? I think it's 88 million. In fact, an impaired loan was advanced towards that. Now, what I want to know is, was this the best economic option available? And the last chair to SARS also. That's my question. As one acknowledges the fact that there has been a decrease on professional and special services, that is from 817.5 million to 746.5 million. One would like to know what is the impact of such on the services of SARS, but also in as far as the aspect of empowerment and economic development of our country's concern. To what extent this procurement of these services is biased towards our domestic talent, or to what extent is this particular services, procurement of these services, assisting us in terms of realizing our agenda in as far as empowering the previous disadvantages concerned? Thank you.
Most people.
Thank you, Chair. I will direct my questions to National Treasury. Chairperson, the recent reports on MTGs, they indicate that we are not going to meet the targets that were set. They even go further to say South Africa in some areas has even gone worse than 3 years ago. Can Treasury share some light with us regarding the reasons for us not doing well in terms of meeting the MDG targets? On non-spending, Chairperson, the DG partly responded in his presentation, but I will ask this question nevertheless. I just want to know from Treasury as to how long does it take for them to detect that a particular department or municipality is not going to spend on what has been allocated, and what are the systems in place to address that situation, but at the same time not compromising service delivery. The last one, Chair, is on the borrowing power. I just want to get if there's any thinking on the side of Treasury to increase or extend its loan with EIB, and what for, and how much, if there is that thinking on the side of Treasury. Thank you, Chair.
Mama Sheila.
Thanks, Chairperson. For being the last, I hope that the officials are not tired of noting the questions. Chair, I've got about four questions that goes to Treasury and two for SARS. With Treasury, this question I think is related to your centrality to service delivery. We have got this project of clean audit by 2014. Now, I just wanted to know what sort of contribution that you can make to assist that this particular project becomes a success. The second question, I think, is in relation to municipalities. When we visited municipalities, we have realized that there are a couple of municipalities which have got funds invested in banks. But on one side, they claim that they've got no funds to actually finance specific activities of service delivery. Now, one wants to just hear your opinion on these particular investments, especially in relation to when you conclude final budget allocations, whether these investments play any meaningful role in the decision making of allocating funds to these municipalities, which have got a lot of money stashed in banks. I think on slide 6, this question relates to the improvement on performance information. Also, when we spoke to some provincial departments, especially in relation to grant spending, we have picked up that when an allocation is transferred from a national department to a provincial department, and the provincial department further transfers the money to a municipality, then it reports back to the national department that the money is spent, whereas it is not spent, it has just simply been transferred to an implementing agent who may not even have spent a cent. But the reports that comes back, they usually tell us that you have got 100% spending on that particular location, whereas it is not. And whether at the level of Treasury, we can try and improve on that particular matter, because it is actually misleading. Then also there is this question, based on your centrality on these service delivery issues, is that a lot of municipalities are owned by national departments, provincial departments, and even some other government agencies. What sort of help can these municipalities receive in order for them to really move towards service delivery and compliance in terms of their audits as well? And then to SARS, we have claimed that more people are submitting returns than in the previous year. One wants to know whether there is any education that is being given that gives results to this, or is it purely because of a stick? Then the second question, I just wanted to really support the question that was raised previously, that the SARS office in Mpumalanga is the busiest office, busier even than a municipal office. I'm not sure whether it is normal that you can have a lot of pupils there running up and down. Is it not an indication of inefficiency? Thanks.
Thank you, Honorable Mashile. To Treasury, from my side, when we visited provinces, it was very clear that provincial treasuries are also struggling in terms of capacity constraints to service smaller municipalities. Now, Section 154 of the Constitution tells us that national government and provincial governments, by legislative and other measures, must support and strengthen the capacity of municipalities to manage their own affairs and to perform their functions. It's just a request. In terms of the Constitution, Section 154, the monitoring and control over from national treasury over provincial treasuries. And this comes out of our experience when the Select Committee on Finance visit provinces, Mpumalanga, Northern Cape, Northwest, and Eastern Cape. We're going back the end of November, beginning of December, to do our follow-ups, to see what improvement were there. But it's just a request from our side. DG and the Commissioner, you may respond and direct the questions to the officials. Thank you.
I think that it's normally said that South Africa is a very unequal society. It's got an inequitable distribution of income. But it looks like in this committee there is an inequitable distribution of questions.
Very active committee.
I will distribute these questions amongst my colleagues. They know the drill. They normally take the difficult questions and leave the simpler ones to me. Accountant General, I'm going to start with you to pick up your questions. The clean audit, the trainees, you do train, and so forth. And Kenneth, there are a range of questions about municipalities and the support that is being provided to the treasuries. Just to say that there's no one as blind as the one who closes their eyes and refuses to see. The support is available. What you can't do is to say to people and say that I am here to provide you support, take it. If they are not taking it, they are not taking it. But we will deal with that. Fuzile, you're very popular today. The capital structure of the SOEs, and why you didn't beat up the department that didn't cooperate with you. The borrowing from EIB, which I have not seen. And Matthew, the PPP, so that you know why you are here. You must deal with those PPPs. Yeah, and then I will pick up the others. And then Kruger. You, CETA, IFMS, those kinds of things. No, I normally deal with them, but because I've got an old timer here, you're going to deal with them. Freeman, let's start with you, just in case you have to.
Thanks, Chair, thanks, DG. I think, let me put myself in trouble first by saying that there was an earlier question that the minister answered around the improvement in the relationship. I think it was raised by Honorable Van Rooyen. The improvement in the cooperation with the law enforcement. I think there is a structure that facilitates that cooperation, and therefore there is a formal and institutionalized way in which that happens. And I think we will reap the benefits going forward. I think that it suffices to say that on that particular question. The financial management grant, the spread of the the municipalities that have taken advantage of this and used it properly, I don't think it's accurate to say that only those municipalities that are in metros are able to, because the very nature of the financial management grant is to enable a municipality. Once you get the money, you go and get the skills. you don't use your own revenue to get the interns. The money that is in the financial management grant is intended to enable a municipality to get interns. So getting the skills is, in fact, facilitated by this grant. But the challenge with municipalities that are in remote areas is because very few individuals would want to go back there and serve in those municipalities. That is the challenge. It's a challenge of attracting skills to those areas rather than because the grant is there to assist municipalities. How do we do to ensure this is realized? It's a difficult one. The concept of district municipalities in our system in this country was meant to address this particular problem. But because leadership in various municipalities would not want to have a situation where they think somebody sitting elsewhere knows what is happening here and perhaps tells other people about what is happening in their localities, the system doesn't quite work. Because that system is meant to enable a situation in which there's a sharing of resources, and in fact that would alleviate the ability to attract people to the various places. So that is a structural challenge. We're looking at ways in which that can be done. There are other initiatives that are meant to train junior staff to ensure municipalities can at least undertake the basic activities that are necessary. The grant and people complying with submitting the financial information, the submitting of the financial information at the end of the year is a function of a few things. One of them is just leadership in municipalities taking these matters seriously. Because if they take the matters seriously, I think they can get the assistance that's necessary to submit the information, whether through provincial treasuries or through national treasury, or through actually using service providers to do that. But the problem, I think, is far deeper than that. Clean audit, what is it that we, is our contribution? We work with the Department of Cooperative Governance in this area. We've set up structures in provinces. We've challenged provinces and municipalities to come up with ways in which they're going to address the challenges that they have. And there's regular meetings where there's follow-up on what progress is being made in this regard. We also provide a lot of guidance. We provide a lot of enabling documents. The 19, for instance, toolkits on GRAP that we did are meant to deal with this thing for municipalities. We came with transitional provisions to simplify accounting standards and application of accounting standards so that municipalities can comply quicker. We provide training and so on. So that is the role that we play as the Treasury. There was, I think, an issue about municipalities that are owed by national departments. I'm sure Mr. Brown will possibly deal with this as well. I think the oversight structures where these departments are should begin to raise questions to those departments. It's a serious problem. There's a cabinet decision that all ministers agreed to that says that all obligations of the state must be met, and they must be met immediately. And therefore, I see no reason why an obligation relating to a municipality is not met by a national department. And we engage with various stakeholders to try and resolve this matter as well. I think that's all for me, TG.
Okay, I'll pass on to the next one. But I see no reason why, if I have not paid my water and light, the municipality switches them off. And when a government department does not pay the water and light, the municipality does not switch them off, because that is how they would get paid. So for me, it's poor credit policy and enforcement. I know we would all say that what would happen if the water and light at the treasury had been switched off. They get switched off via the DG.
I mean, I do not understand why it is such a difficult thing. The law is there, it's clear. You've got to pay all the accounts due within 30 days of being presented, and the same thing happens with municipalities. My take is that the problem is probably more complicated than just that people are not paying. It has to also do with the billing chaos in the municipalities. So if the billing systems are not functioning properly, it is difficult for them to enforce these things. But from where we're standing, they say a decision that the regulations must be observed as they stand. I do know that if the Auditor General picks up that there are particular invoices that are not paid within that period, they do raise it in their report, either in the management letter or as some matter of emphasis because it's a failure to comply with regulations. I think that is as straightforward as that. Fellows, Kenneth, I'm going to go to you now to deal with this other stuff. Don't give a sermon.
Yeah. By implication, did you say you gave a sermon on this thing? Thank you, DG, Honorable Chairs. On the government debt, Honorable Machila, once it comes to our attention in the Treasury, we also just take it up with the relevant kind of departments. We bring them together and we try and force it out. But in addition to that, what we've also done within our unit is to get somebody who will be dedicated into looking at the billing systems and all of that. What we will be doing in the next year, for example, is to, in each province, target one or two municipalities in each province that has got the potential to generate quite a bit of revenue and see how we can actually enhance their billing systems basically there. And through that also have our provincial treasuries to peer learn and to be able to roll it out basically to the rest of the municipalities in that area. Honorable Ms. Lamini, on the compliance assessment report, what we've got a compliance assessment kind of guide that we use, which has got about 18 kind of factors that we basically look into. Now, we use that to assess basically the credibility of a municipality's budget, our 17 municipalities. So, as you are aware, municipalities must table draft budgets by March each year, and they must also submit those to the Treasury. So the 17 that we get, we use that, and we'll be able to share you that specific document, how we go about it, basically out of that. And we've got reports, we can make those specific reports available to you. But that's on the budget preparation kind of side. On the implementation side, I mean, we've got a monthly kind of return that we get, basically Section 71 report that we get, basically from municipalities. 3-4 years ago, the reporting on those reports were close to, I would say, 10-15% for that matter, and the quality of that information was extremely kind of weak. But I can say now that we, of our 283 municipalities, we get close to 100% kind of reporting, basically, on it. I've got somebody there with a very big stick who's really sorting out the municipalities to report on it. And we see the quality of that report are actually also improving, basically, over time. Now that municipalities realize that on a quarterly basis, we also publish those reports. And it's also on our website. You can get it basically there. And now that they know that they are published, when media queries come, we refer the media directly to the municipality. So they also now start to realize that they need to make sure that they provide us with accurate kind of information. The information is there. We will be able to make that information available. I don't know, Honorable Chair, Mr. Chan asked questions and he ran away on some of these things. But I think let me answer his questions because they relate to the infrastructure grant to provinces. The infrastructure grant to provinces makes up roughly about a quarter of infrastructure spending in provinces. Possibly provinces spend about 40 billion rand annually on infrastructure, and we give about 10, 11 billion of that, basically. Now, when reporting takes place, you don't expect a province to report on the grant itself. We don't want them to report on the 10 billion. We want them to report on the 40 billion rand, basically. All right? So much so, if you take agriculture, for example, What you want to look for is not the portion that goes in there from the grant for agriculture, but what does the province do with its entire agriculture kind of budget. That is what we want to basically look into. The Honourable also member also raised the issue around mud schools. About 3 years ago, 2.7 billion rand was added for mud schools, and let me not call it mud school, the eradication of unsafe structures, education structures. This is actually the first year where the big amount is going to be spent. Now, I want to link that to the introductory, I think, part of the comment that was made around how do we implement our infrastructure program, specifically social infrastructure, World Cup, with that bang kind of approach. What we are now basically looking into, and we hope, as the Minister have indicated, by the time we get to the budget, to be able to announce how we're going to eradicate, as a start, the entire, or not necessarily eradicate, but accelerate the delivery of education infrastructure, basically there. Which may mean that the current funding that is there for education infrastructure will firstly be augmented, but then it will be managed also differently. And we are in the process of looking at the mechanics on how we're going to deal with that. On the coal haulage route, currently we are in discussions with the Department of Transport, so that we can find quite a bit of a different dispensation to be able to deal with how we manage the coal haulage route in Mpumalanga, and how we finance the rest of the road infrastructure, basically. Out of that, we will also be able to make specific kind of proposals on how we're going to deal with it. But generally, it's not only about the coal haulage route, it's actually how the entire provincial infrastructure roads system is actually managed that we're starting to look into. As you may recall, the Minister of Transport actually alluded to the fact that about the issues around maintenance itself and how we actually need to address it there. So that matter is now basically under discussion, and we will be able to possibly by the time of the budget make specific pronouncements around it there. On support for provincial treasuries, I mean, Currently, provincial treasury, each provincial treasury receives about an augmented amount of 5 million rand, right, through its equitable share. And part of that money must be used to bolster its MFMA units within the treasuries, right? And that's one of the areas where the treasuries has been slow, and we are now starting to push them to try and get the staff employed. But in addition to that, we have engaged with the DBSA as well, and the DBSA is funding specific experts now within the National Treasury, so that we get assistance to manage our 17 municipalities and also do proper oversight of all 9 provinces in terms of oversight of municipal finances there. But what we will be doing with those specific 18 experts, we'll be employing 2 each, basically, per province, so that they are basically the treasury, the National Treasury's hands on kind of people on the ground, basically, to be able to make sure that the quality of financial management in those municipalities actually improves, and reporting takes place, and the rest of what is expected from a municipality to do in terms of finances, it does it expeditiously, basically. Honorable Mr. Van Rooyen, IDOP is continuing. So there is funding in the current budget over the next 3 years for IDOC to continue. I think government acknowledges the fact that it is important that that program actually continues. The difference is it will be managed now by the Technical Assistance Unit within the National Treasury. But we also want provinces to start to take full ownership, basically, of the program. So there is that kind of link that we would continue to deal with, basically, there. My handwriting is letting me down, yeah, but I think it's Sibida. How quick can National Treasury detect that the department is going to over or understand, basically? I think, let me just step a bit back. I hope I'll end my sermon, basically, with this. Through that cash or funding compliance assessment tool that we actually have, we are even so proactive that we can start to tell a municipality that in 4 months' time, before you even, when you table your budget, 3-4 months later you're going to be in trouble. And one municipality, once they got our report, went through it and realized that they are actually indeed going to be in trouble. And but unfortunately they couldn't adjust their budget, so they have to wait for an adjustment budget to take place. And that municipality, after 3-4 months in the financial year, actually has been in trouble. And we could detect it quickly and we could put in a remedial kind of steps to be able to assist the municipality that it actually doesn't falter on its on its creditors, for example, basically there. But we use the information that we also get. Right. Now, the first 2-3 months of a financial year, normally that information will not be able to really tell you whether the department will be able to over or underspend, basically. But as the year progresses, by the time you get to the first 6 months, the warning lights are basically there. And we assess that kind of information, and we indicate to departments, for example, that are responsible for conditional grants, that there are red flags. Yeah, and these are the areas that you need to basically intervene in. You must remember, for example, with conditional grants, other departments are responsible for the oversight of those specific kind of grants. And in our case, we would give them an indication that you may have problems here and you may want to intervene. You may want to deal with your payment schedule in a different way if there's a chance that you're going to overspend or there's pressure on it. So the systems are becoming quite a bit robust to be able to deal with that. I hope, Mr. De Beer, I've answered your question in bolstering the provincial treasuries. Thank you, DJ.
Kruger, I know you are a man of few words.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think it was the Honorable Adams that asked the questions around the IFMS, and let me specifically address those, because you referred to the lead sites, the further rollout into defense, and then also the capacity that needed to be created in CETA. Where we stand at the moment, we are busy implementing the two commercial off-the-shelf systems in the lead sites, and the asset management module, which is an in-house bespoke development module, which was developed by CETA in lead sites. The lead sites, in respect of the procurement, commercial off-the-shelf abbreviated COTS module, we are making steady progress. We've had certain challenges around the complexity and protracted nature of the contract negotiations, but by and large we're on track, but there will be a few months delay in actually concluding the blueprints and the actual generic templates, which can then serve for rolling out to the rest of government. On the HR module, which is also a COTS module, again, similar, the completion of the generic template is slightly late, but not materially, because we've actually started the processes of advertising the bids earlier than originally scheduled. So by and large, we're on track there, but there are challenges, and I will elaborate on those in a minute. On the asset management, the lead sites that were identified were Limpopo National Treasury. We have implemented very successfully, and that was the proof of concept in-house bespoke development module that CETA has produced. They produced that, and I think in terms of the responses that we got back from fora like GovTech and so on, people were very impressed with the demonstrations and the CFO forum and so on. So I think they did a pretty good job there. The rollout to the other lead sites in Limpopo, firstly, namely Department of Agriculture, Roads and Transport, and Housing. Those will commence very soon, and then ultimately, and by the way, National Treasury has also been implemented. That was not scheduled as a lead time, so that's a quick win. Defense is a bit more of a challenge. They should be a lead site for both asset management and procurement. But because they have so many homegrown subsystems, the reintegration into the lead sites, in other words, the determination of the scope, is something that we're working through at the moment as a critical element. So we're imminent to start there. And then obviously in the Department of Defense, the internal capacity is very strong. So by and large, they would be doing the implementation themselves in conjunction with CETA. So we don't really see that as a challenge. But because of the uniqueness of the defense environment, we would rather be cautious on the side of integration and reintegration, because the implication would be dual capturing of information if you get it wrong. They've got quite a number of subsystems. I think it runs into the 20s, so we're working through those. So it's just something that we need to be careful. But as the DG, Honorable Chair, as indicated in this presentation, we have our challenges with CETA. As you know, CETA was designated to be the primary or the prime systems integrator for the financial management systems. We are running into capacity constraints in that environment. CETA has been busy with a turnaround strategy for a long, long time. There's an acting CEO, there's an acting CFO, there's an acting company secretary. Everybody in Exco is acting. It's very difficult in an environment like that to make the progress, and I've agreed with the acting CEO that perhaps it would be a good suggestion that we make a joint presentation to the committee so that CETA could convince the committee that they would be able to meet their responsibilities as a primary system integrator. But please don't despair. The IFMS will continue, and we have mitigating strategies that we can implement, and we're at the point now where we need to very decisively decide which way to go. If they can't do the job, then say so, come clean, and let us then go the route. Now, the options are the following. In terms of the Cabinet Resolution of 2005 that directed the continuation of the implementation or the replacement, which is not really an option, we have to replace. The current systems are so outdated, they're running on outdated technology, natural adabats. The people that can support those systems are either retiring or passed on, and the youngsters obviously don't want to be trained in obsolescent technologies. So the advantage is that we've developed through CETA the architectural platform, so we're in a position to set the standards. We've got the intellectual property. We're going open standards route, Java technology, which the potential supporters are readily available. This is you know, what people, or the younger people, the younger generation are being trained on. So we've made the right choices. The question, though, is what do we do? And the questions revolve specifically around, did they put the call center in place? Do they have the support capacity? Do they have the training capacity? The question that you did not ask and should have asked also is, do they have the capacity to test the systems as they are being developed and delivered? The answer is very limited. And that would impact very severely not this year, but next year. If I don't have those capacities in place, we will not be able to roll out the IFMS as per the planned schedule. That's the long and the short of it. So we have to make serious interventions. Cabinet in its resolution said CETA should be assessed prior to the handing or the formal final handing over of the project to them. If they are assessed now, we will not make the grade. You can quote me on that. And that's where we stand. So we have to go the route of either augmenting their skills through private partnership arrangements and insourcing of capacity, but in such a way that they retain the intellectual property, and we have those mitigating strategies in place. So it's just a question of taking it forward, and the time to act is now. Otherwise, next year, when we come to the full rollout, we will not make the targets. Thank you.
EG, we would like you the officials to be brief in their reply. There won't be follow-up questions. We're going to deal with the MTBBS in 14 days from today, 13 days. Then we can sit again, because we would like to finish at 1:30.
Thank you. Guys, you have heard for yourself. Your answers do not have to be as long as the questions.
Thanks, sir. I suppose if I happen not to be clear, it will be because I'm trying to be very brief. Let me start at the bottom of the question. On the EIB loan, we haven't made any decision now whether we will roll it over when it's due to be redeemed. The decision on that would have to be informed, amongst other things, by whether at the time the loan was taken, relative to the time when it will mature, we would be better served by rolling it over on those old terms, assuming, of course, we've got use for the money because there's no glory in debt, or whether we can get money in better terms at that stage. So no decision has been taken on that now. On the saving on intergovernmental cash coordination, what would happen is that at any given time, one of the 10 governments might run a surplus. It might have more cash than the expenditure commitments at that point in time. Similarly, we've drawn into this the state-owned entities now. Some of them would have cash reserves that they plan to use in the future. They've got no use for them immediately. Others may have loans that they have made drawdowns on because they have to, in terms of the loan agreement. So we pool these resources. And rather than give them to the banks to lend to us at higher rates, we agree to pool the resources amongst ourselves, and we give each other the money in cheaper terms than the terms that would have obtained if we were to get the money through the banks. In terms of the specific components, then, I've already alluded to that, that is cash reserves, loans that come from, in terms of SOEs.
But that one is skipped. Move to the next one.
Okay. The 33%, the capital structure project, it ran behind schedule, but it will be finished by December. So in this financial year, it will be finished. We may have appeared as though we were helpless in the way we articulated this stuff in the presentation, but we did make ways to get the project to move. On the amount owed by the sub to us, that relates to the reserves, because we give them the money to sterilize, we are like depositors to them, and therefore they owe us the money. It's not their money, that's how they reflect it. It's not a candidate as a liability. It's our asset that's kept by them on our behalf.
DJ, can I just quickly use the first example to answer Honorable Mashila's one question that I've missed on the bank accounts and the investments in municipalities? Now, if we've listened to Lungisa's question for provinces and national government, there's a natural cushion
for them to be able to finance their obligations. But when it comes to municipalities, they are on their own, if you think about it. So they need to build up a bit of reserve to be able to carry them. If their cash flows move in a different direction, if people default in payment at certain times, they are actually on their own. So what you have is they will build 4 or 5 months of kind of reserves so that they can carry themselves, basically. The question would be, must it be 4 months or 8 months? In some cases, it becomes very exorbitant, but we can have that discussion on it.
Okay. Well, the question about the term of the audit committee, the manner in which these reports are done is that we must report as at the end of the financial year. We have got a full audit committee as it stands. There are two of the members who didn't renew their term, but they had been replaced. So we have got a fully functioning audit committee. So we do not have a problem. The process to appoint members, we go through a search. We are very picky as the treasury as to who sits in our audit committee. The previous chair was the former executive director of the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants, and we have got people of very high standing on our audit committee. So that's the process. The question about Momo, you must answer the question about the consumer protection and the financial sector. But then there was a question that about what the DG of Trade and Industry said yesterday. I tried to send him an SMS to say exactly what did you say. He has not responded. So it's difficult for me to say anything with respect to that. Suffice to say that the financial sector in South Africa undertook a process and came with the financial sector charter. That sector reports, the Financial Sector Charter Council reports through to this committee on an annual basis as to how they are doing in terms of implementation of the charter. I don't think that they need to be included with some intervention. I think what the Honorable Member should do is to ask the Director General of the DTI when they are gazetting the Financial Sector Charter, because then we wouldn't have to do any intervention. That would help us. Matthew, you're going to deal with the PPPs. There was a question raised about the rating of South Africa and the ranking. We must be very careful, because there are ratings and there are rankings. Anybody out there can start a process to rank anything. There was a newspaper which used to rank DGs on an annual basis, one that was ranking ministers. You know, just ranking, right? And I am aware of a report of a foundation run by one of the former presidents that said that our ranking has declined. Depends what is being measured. There had been one that had been run with respect to economic openness that said that we are declining. For us sitting in the Treasury, what matters is two important areas. One is competitiveness. How does South Africa rank with respect to competitiveness? And there is two important studies. One is done by the World Bank. It's called the Ease of Doing Business. And the other one is run by the World Economic Forum. So we would watch those. The most important one for us had been, in spite of serious dents to their credibility, had been the rating agencies. Because those ratings determine whether you are able to access money in capital markets and at what cost you would be able to access the money. As I had said, in as far as South Africa is concerned, our ratings have either been stable or they have improved. So there is nothing to worry about with respect to that. There was a question about the technical assistance, the TAs, and the discrepancy that we said 36 and the in program 3727, a careful reading will show that the 27 refers to the number of departments in which the technical assistance had been placed, and the 36 refers to the actual technical assistance. I think it comes clearer in program 7. It spells out and distinguishes between those two. So that deals with that. And Momo, shoot.
Thank you, Gigi. With regard to consumer protection, I think the question was, should we change our program to make it fit? I think, Dr. George, firstly, with regard to consumer protection, that falls within the FSB, and we've been having discussions to address gaps, for example, like market conduct over banking charges. I think we feel that this area is quite important, and therefore we are looking at how to step up the whole market conduct function within the regulatory environment. There are challenges like you raised, like for example the question was raised on the Guardian's fund. Currently what you have is certain funds, particularly if they fall under the state, be it a pension fund of a state entity or our own pension fund, or if you take the Guardian's fund, they may fall under, they often get exempted from general legislation, firstly, and may also fall on other departments. I think this is part of the challenge of how to deal with a plethora of these issues, which really often, given that the system's so fragmented, I think just makes it easier to have the kinds of problems we have. Thank you.
Matthew, PPP can also deal with the performance information.
On the PPPs, you know, I think the information in the book stands. We don't have an update on the feasibility studies within the provincial health departments yet. The PPP model within that environment remains extremely attractive. It understandably has the ability to enhance the quality of service provided, and we are continuing to work very closely with the national and provincial departments to make sure that these are worked through. But there are a number of complexities related to this, a natural tension between the departments and the private partners that needs to be resolved. Some of these complexities are expected, others kind of emerge as you move through that. So that is an area that we continue to push quite hard behind in order to complete the remaining four feasibility studies. On the standardized provisions, I believe that's going to be, the drafting of that will be completed in 6 weeks, if I understood your question correctly. On the performance information, I think that there's a very interesting opportunity emerging between the Department of Monitoring and Evaluation and ourselves. There are obvious and important overlaps that happen where we are involved in the evaluation of predominantly financial information, but also we do cover a lot of the more general performance information, and that is an important process that is taking place between ourselves and that department in order to collate and combine the capacity and roles of the two functions.
Thank you. There was also a question about the work of the FSC, and we work with the FSC. We, by law, we have to respond to their reports. So when we take a stance in terms of the division of revenue and so forth, they will come, they will give us a report, and we have to respond to that, and our response to the FSC recommendations gets tabled. Commissioner, you are on your own.
You know, matters of policy leave a lot of grey areas. When you come to us from an administration point of view, it's either you owe us money or you don't. So there isn't a lot of grey area. We will be very quick. We'll ask 7 questions. The first one came from the Honorable Mr. George about the tax broadening side. I will just have this to say, Mr. George, there are 3 areas on which we do tax broadening. One is at filing level, which is whether you comply and you are in the net. And then there's the declaration level, whether you declare the amount that you're supposed to declare or you are under declaring. And then there's the payment level, you know, broadening at the payment level, whether you are paying what is due on time or with the interest and penalties that are due. And we have different strategies which we employ to approach the broadening for those three categories. And we go to both ends, both the example that you made in terms of small business, taxes, and so on, and we employ different tools to be able to increase the level of compliance and broadening of the tax base there. But we also have other strategies that we employ, for example, at the high end. For example, I mean, we announced in a week ago that we have recovered rediscovered a tax planning scheme which exploited the provisions that exist in our tax, in the double taxation treaties that we signed with many organizations, where people have this foreign tax credit. You know, they generate foreign tax credit, to try and you know, take advantage of the provisions in the double taxation, as I say. And two or so financial institutions, big ones, you know, have paid us over 3 billion rand with just one scheme. So you can imagine if you compare that to having to run around, you know, taxes that that collect on average per taxi 50,000 rands a day. I mean, 50,000 a year, rands a year. So we have to deploy our very scarce resources based on the biggest yield. And still the biggest yield is still in these other financial institutions that employ this, as the minister said, it's this creative and undesirable innovations. So the broadening of the tax base, there are huge opportunities there. But I'll give Joseph Rock to talk a little bit more on specific segments. On those particular segments, in those three categories, what is it that we do? And then the next question, while Mr. Rock is presenting and preparing himself, I think it was Mr. Kuranov who said the queues are long, takes too long for us to get in there. I'll give that to Barry Hall. There are a few questions that he will answer as the Chief Operating Officer. But suffice to say that, you know, on that end, we have seen and we realize that we have to expand our footprint. There is no way. With the growing tax register, the level of compliance, and the eagerness of people to comply, particularly early. I mean, we had the end of September as the deadline for manual submissions, not electronic submissions, but our offices were overwhelmed there. You know, we're supposed to be processing at least 30,000 people per day. You know, in peak hours, we experience 120,000 people going through our network of 42 offices. So you can understand that we can't gear for peak either, you know. But I think, yes, for sure, there is a need for extra offices, particularly in outlying areas. For example, we don't have an office in Centurion, in Pretoria. We don't have an office in, you know, in Mhlanga, in Durban, for example. And there are lots of expanding areas where we need some sizable amount. And that thing relates to the Mpumalanga question from Honorable Mr. Mashile on at the Nelspruit office. I mean, the Nelspruit office, Mr. Mashile, as you know, is in the fourth floor or fifth floor of the building. So you literally, when you get in, you'll think there's congestion, but because we have people, you know, hanging around the stairs and while actually the fiscal infrastructure is woefully inadequate, and we have a program which in this financial year we are going to move. We have actually procured the land to move our offices in Nelspruit. So we do have infrastructure and congestion issues, especially at peak, that we have to do. But Barry will add any other thing that I might have omitted there. And it also address the stability of our operating system. We really feel like, you know, if comparisons are started to be made to our system compared to e-Natos and Cipro, I mean, you know, we will debunk that mess. We make sure when we design systems that firstly they are stable, firstly they can operate, and then we have a backup plan. But Barry will explain all those things from Honorable Mr. Lee. He will talk to you about the utilization and the downtime that you have experienced, you know, lately. And then whether Trijet or the software system that Honorable Van Rooyen asked, the custom system, whether it was the best economic option, he will also deal with that thing. And then our Chief Financial Officer, Trix, will deal with the BEE spent on our operating budget. And then the last question was the reasons for higher filing. We have an engagement. Our compliance model has got three components, Honorable Mashile. On the one side, it's, you know, enforcement, and then education and service on the other side. So engagement and making sure that we grow our tax register is part of our strategy. You know, I was just looking in the annual report, and we've had 7,228 engagement, which on average we have about 2,000 people attending those kind of engagement. And we have targeted particular non-compliant areas where we give people education, because some people don't comply simply because they don't know they have to comply. And that we believe is one of the reasons why, you know, there's a higher level of compliance. But there's also another, a second reason for that, and that is, you know, we have third-party verification, we have pre-population of returns, which has made it very easy for people to do these things. Before, when you have to fill your return, you needed a consultant, you needed too many other backing documents, and so on. Now, suddenly, all those things are pre-populated in your return. You just have to go into our offices, check it, and then it makes it much more easier for people to fulfill their obligations. So that's one of the reasons. Not only the stick of penalties, you know. Yes, that has a desirable impact, and we're going to continue to strengthen and make sure that, you know, those that don't willingly do this thing, they have to do this thing. Otherwise, the tax system is unfair and puts too much burden on those that want to comply. So let me give this to Joseph Rock, and then we'll be followed by Barry immediately. And then six, and then that's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. As the Commissioner mentioned, as far as broadening the tax base is concerned, you know, there are a number of levers that we have available to us. But essentially, there's two components that we're looking to make sure that we achieve. The one is to make sure that everybody who should be in the net is in the tax net, and that once they're in the net, everybody is paying their fair share. Now, honourable members will recall when we presented our strategic plan earlier in the year, we outlined that we were taking a segmentation approach. And essentially, it's because you can't apply the same model for all taxpayers. So essentially what we do, we divide up the taxpayer base. We have certain strategies we apply to large business. We apply certain different strategies to medium business, small business, high net worth individuals, etc. And there's a number of programs that we have running. So as you've heard today, we use third-party data to verify that what people have told us actually conforms with what information we get from elsewhere. We have mechanisms where when people have tried to hide money overseas, we exchange information with other administrations, etc. As far as industries like the taxi industry are concerned, well, again, part of segmenting into small business allows us then to look at the various industries that make up a particular segment, and then we can compare how did different players look in a particular segment from a tax perspective. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chairs. I think our Commissioner did a reasonably good job of explaining the need to increase the capacity that we've got in our branches, and in the interest of time, I'd add only one point. I think we're a little bit of the victim of our own success. The ability to get a refund for your tax return by walking into one of our branches and within 48 hours has obviously brought significant additional numbers to visit us. And having said that, we're looking at the capacity in those branches that we do have and finding ways to move out back office activities to centralized locations and hoping to create more space. But there are safety and health regulations that prevent us doing more than a certain limited amount of activities in that space. So the right answer is additional capacity, of which the Commissioner has already mentioned. If I turn to the Honourable Mr. Lees, I think we would be saddened if we thought our systems were unstable. I do come from quite a long time in the banking industry, and I understand stability. We can always be better, but I don't think we have unstable systems. The question of capacity and difficulty of getting into the system at certain times, we continue to improve that on an ongoing basis. We've just added additional capacity. But again, the volumes grow at quite significant speed as more and more people take it on, and as more and more people, or as we broaden what is available on e-filing. So now there's provisional tax, which also puts an additional burden, and as we were quite surprised this year that over 90% of the people decided to use the electronic way to file provisional tax. But it's something that we can always focus on, and I'd be interested in your own circumstances that you said, because we will continue to look for ways to improve that. As to our custom solution from the Honourable Mr. Van Rijn, we had a modernization tender in 2006 where we were able to test the global market. And in fact, the Cladet organization was part of the winning consortium. So we have a very good idea of the economics and why it was the best way to go. We just found it a better risk-reward answer to be able to own the business. But that's the short answer. There's a much longer one if we have time. Thank you.
I'm going to handle the question on procurement. The numbers in the annual financial statements, I would like to use the 2 billion rand. It's 746 on professional services and about 1.3 billion on administrative expenses. Of that, 67.8% is now BBBE, and in improved levels within that. How did we achieve it? By breaking down tenders. Instead of putting a tender out, it is half an opportunity to bring it into a regional base to give it smaller. The biggest obstacle to some of these BBBE companies is the size of some of these tenders. So we now make it a regional tender and give the smaller person an option. I can also say that the sum total of payments in hard currency, either not South African payments, not rand, is less than 0.5% of our total expenditure. So it's not even 10 million rand if you then deduct the amount that we pay for international subscriptions. And being part of international membership for the forums that we participate in, there's nothing. So it's, local is lacquer for us, and we spend a lot of, as I say, 67.8% is our BBBE spend. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Secretary.
Thank you for the competent way the questions were answered. In Kimberley, SARS moved into bigger offices, and it's actually a pleasure to go there. That's a report from my wife. So I'm just conveying the message. Thank you for that. Honourable members, thank you for your participation. I'm going to ask the co-chair, Honourable Thabo Mofumahadi, to do the closing remarks, and then we will adjourn.
thanks, co-chair. Just looking at the response of the honourable members about whether we need to proceed or not, I think what we should do is to say and put it to test that lunch is ready. Maybe we should break for lunch and come back if honourable members are willing to do that. I can hear there's no popular support of this view. There's no popular support for this view. But clearly, DG and the Commissioner, as always, your presentation gives more answers than questions. But would have loved to engage with you much more in detail also. Unfortunately, this process that we are embarking on now is a very, very tight program, as you know, in terms of the new act that governs our business in Parliament. Just two comments that I think you'd need to take with you. One is around the ease of corruption and savings that Honourable Luyenga touched on earlier on. The minister did respond on this particular matter. That from where one is sitting, the observation that we have is that the institutions that we have on the ground, I'm not talking about investigating capacities in terms of the state agencies to deal with this matter, but just as national treasury and provincial treasuries. At the provincial level, I think most of provincial treasuries, they exist, but they don't seem to understand that they've got the power and the capacity to can stop certain things. And I think national treasury needs to step in there and assist. The second part of, or second set of issues in that score or in that area, is that national treasury must not just make an observation and leave these issues to others to act. In the last budget council where I had the opportunity to attend with my colleague and others, clearly you had a situation where in provinces, some offices, particularly at the provincial level, premier's offices, have got more personnel than the Department of, say, of Economic Development. Now, that raises the question, is that a delivery program that these people are engaged in? It may be a legacy problem, particularly from homes, Bantu stands. But 15 years into democracy, you cannot promote that. It might be things that we've created ourselves. So I think National Treasury shouldn't just observe and make recommendations through MTEC hearings and said, this is our observation. The question is, after observing, what then do you do with that information? It can't be something that we just leave hanging. So I think it is important that we find a way. And I'm just taking the PFMA in terms of the responsibilities and the powers and functions of provincial treasuries. It is very, very clear what they should be able to do at that level. The second issue, which I thought we should be able to say to you as we move forward, is on Program 4, Financial Management and Systems, the establishment of the supply chain management compliance and so on and so forth, and the release of public comments draft interim measures to align preferential procurement with the aims of triple BEE. I think yes, the joint committees would want to make a follow-up on these two issues. Particularly around the supply chain management issues. We have been talking about it. I know, Kunle, we have been working on this particular matter for many years. It has been evolving and evolving. But insofar as where we are going, I think the two respective committees would want to engage with you, particularly even on the issue of your public comments. And so on. Once the document is there or the papers are there, it will be important that the committee gets seized with this work to assist you, because this is the heart of our attempt and your attempt as government to deal with fruitless expenditure and probably corruption. The last point, this goes to SARS, in terms of your annual report, particularly the last slide. In fact, slide number 5 and slide number 6, your slide number 6 does include, indicate in terms of your debt book, it's almost a 15 billion rand increase in the debt. And your credit book has declined by 5 billion rand, just from interpolation of the graph here or the slide. But still, you have managed to meet your targets for 2010 in terms of the projections as projected last year in terms of the decline in revenue. But you have been able to do some wonders in that respect. It might be interesting for us at some point, even if we write a one-page, what has caused this increase in your debtors book, whether it's because companies are not able to sustain themselves because of the recession and so on and so forth, or is it because of people who are or institutions that are deliberately increasing their innovative mechanisms for avoidance of their responsibilities. The last slide, second from last, slide number 13. I think we really welcome your intervention as SARS in rescuing the FIFA Soccer World Cup IT problems, your intervention in the Department of Home Affairs. But now of late, and this also goes to the DG, I was watching the news one day, and the Director General of Home Affairs, Mr. Aplani, indicated that there is a possibility of, in fact, they are putting a contingency fund in terms of litigation case of almost 6 billion rand, which arises out of, I wouldn't want to say irregularities at this point in time, because this is a matter that is being contested and challenged, but disputes around how the tenders were awarded within Home Affairs. Now, I don't want to assume that internally within SARS you have got the capacity, as an in-house capacity, to deal with the challenges in Home Affairs. It might be that internally you are also getting assistance from other companies to do what was supposed to have been happening in Home Affairs and elsewhere. Now, the procurement process within your own systems or within your own institution should not also lead us to the same problems that we've had in Home Affairs. So I just wanted to make this point. I'm not saying there's anything, but it will be important that 5 billion rand, that is at dispute now, almost 6 billion rand, that is the money that can go to service delivery in a very, very big way in the country. If possible, we need to avoid that kind of thing. But we can only do it if we make sure that we follow the right procedures ourselves to procure for services from whoever are the service providers. So I thought I should just make this comment. Areas of follow-ups is those two areas that I indicated earlier on in terms of the supply chain management and the broad-based black economic employment programs that you are trying to improve on. And I think I should thank you, Coach, and thank everybody who has had the patience of listening and also engaging. But most importantly, to thank you, DG, and the Minister in absentia, the Commissioner, and for your team for continuously being at the forefront of the battlefront of fighting poverty and making sure that our economy remains resilient, at the same time attracts new problems of the currency war and creates a new problem also for the governor of the Reserve Bank on interest rates, because the good things that you do also attract new problems for ourselves. Thank you very much. That's a good problem that we have as a country. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. This meeting is adjourned.